It's time for Twink This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis and Aunt Pruitt are here. Stacy has the week off. And we have a very special guest. The man who invented WordPress, founded Automattic, which owns WordPress.com and PocketCast.com and Tumblr.com, the great Matt Mullenweg, coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 681, recorded Wednesday, September 14th, 2022. Drop, cover, and hold on. This Week in Google is brought to you by IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla. IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. Hosted by Bridget Todd, this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Search for IRL in your podcast player. And by Cashfly. Deliver your video on the network with the best throughput and global reach, making your content infinitely scalable. Go live in hours, not days. Learn more at cashfly.com. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show we cover the latest news from, well, not just the Googleverse, the Twitterverse, the Facebook verse, but as it turns out, the WordPress verse. Let me introduce our panel, and then we'll introduce our very special guest. Aunt Pruitt is here from Hands On Photography. Hi, Aunt.
Hello, sir. How
you
be?
You're in the Stacy seat today. We'll put you over in Stacy's seat. She's got the day off. Jeff Jarvis is also here. Should we do the whole rigmarole?
No, because I'm in mourning, Leo.
Oh, wow. You look like
a
Sith Lord. What's
that
the matter?
Palpatine.
The Chromebook, Pixelbook.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we'll get to that.
Yeah,
that's just a rumor at this point.
No, I think it's gone.
Jeff is the Leonard Tow Professor for Journalistic Innovation at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of...
Craig Newmark!
A little late. A little late, but that's okay. I'm New York. Now, Jeff.
Now the important part.
I want you to introduce our very special... guest. Matt Mullenweg is here.
Matt Mullenweg is, you all know, the founder of Automattic, co-founder of WordPress, genius at social media, savior of various services, including Tumblr and others. And what we'll talk about soon is Matt's vision and model for how he built the way I think the internet should be built. But first, back to you, Leo. And
then Matt, really nice to have you on. I used WordPress in the very earliest days. Big fan. I think we've talked before on some of our shows, but it's really nice to welcome you back, especially because you're such a big shot now.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. WordPress.com, WooCommerce, Pocket Cast, recently saved from the jaws of public radio. Simple Note, which has always been great. These are all Automattic holdings. Tumblr, which you saved from the deep, evil, dark lords at Yahoo. Jetpack, which, of course, has been a long time, a wonderful plugin for WordPress users, as is Akismet, the anti-spam filter. I don't know Happy Tools, but this
Newspack
is on the list. Newspack, great. Day One, another recent acquisition, a wonderful journaling program I've used for years on iOS. Long Reads, I didn't know you owned that. And Gravatar. Yeah. Wow. You're building a publishing would be the common thing here, yes?
We really love internet infrastructure. So things that make other things go. And one nice thing about Automattic, we're about 2,000 people now.
Wow.
Which is far bigger than I would have ever imagined. But 93 countries, I think. We've always been totally distributed from the beginning because we came out of an open source project. And so, you look at a room of automaticians, you couldn't see more different hairstyles, dress, everything. Like, everyone's very different, but really united with this idea of craft and of building the web for the long term. So very, very different people who have come together to try to, as Stuart Brand would say, be good ancestors on the web.
I guess we are all ancestors. I never thought of that.
Yeah. Stuart Woods, too.
Stuart Wood. When did you start WordPress?
2003.
Wow.
I was 19. Mm. So
you were 19.
20th anniversary next year.
And Mike, we should give Mike little credit as well for starting it with you. PHP.
I commented on my blog and and we just started working together and that turned into this thing.
Truly an amazing success. It runs, what percentage of the internet now runs on WordPress?
I think about 42. Although I will give the caveat now that that number is about to change because speaking of things shutting down, like the Pixelbook, that number was based on Alexa data.
Oh, good Lord.
W3Techs would use the top 10 million websites from Alexa, and that was the index. And
a plugin, right? That people would run on their browser, a search plugin they'd run on their browser, and that way you could see all the sites they went to. And it's still around, isn't it? Are you still?
Amazon's finally shutting it down. Oh. So, and the data will be gone. So Alexa's now just a voice assistant, no longer a web ranking kind of thing.
Yeah, before there was Alexa, there was Alexa. Yeah, I installed WordPress and MySQL on my my blog hosting platform probably around 2005.
We used to teach all of our journalism students to install instances of WordPress.
Yeah.
Learn how to do that.
Yeah.
They don't really need to now, but it was in the time, it was a core skill.
And WordPress.com then kind of took over as a managed hosting. And I would bet at least half of WordPress sites are on WordPress.com now, yes?
Actually, under 1% are.
What?
What?
So it's still a big open source project. Wow.
Yeah, maybe a couple percent, but like, yeah, it's the vast majority of WordPresses in the world are run on different web hosts around the world. You know, Bluehost, WP Engine, cloud services, DigitalOcean, like you can run WordPress. You can run it on a Raspberry Pi. You can run it pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
And so, pretty resilient.
That's really cool. Well,
we actually have a fun new proposal that I'm very excited about.
What's that?
That came out of, we just had a WordCamp United States last weekend in San Diego. And, you know, I've been studying and admiring projects that are building for the long term. And one that I mentioned on stage was SQLite, SQLite, which is this flat file database that's super fast. And they're designing it to be portable and thinking about it in terms of decades, like how would this data be accessible? And as a pretty cool proposal someone put up to actually have WordPress be able to run on SQLite instead of just MySQL. Whoa. So that would be, we might get some core support for that. I think that would be pretty neat for longevity.
WordCamp Pittsburgh is where we met iJustine for the first time.
And
we're so impressed by her energy. This was, early 2000s. I don't remember when this was, a long time ago. And
it was a fun work camp in San Diego because it was, we had a cap the attendance at like 650 because of the venue. And so it felt like one of the old ones.
Old fashioned. And, that's nice.
So cool.
Jeff has said this a couple of weeks ago. I think this was the impetus to get you on, is that you did it right. Jeff, what did you mean by that?
So Matt, here's the premise that I gave. I recalled when the partners a few of them at Polaris called me many years ago. When I was in the car driving, and they said, this guy, Matt, we like, and we like this WordPress thing, but he has a really weird model where it's going to be open source and then a company on top of that, and we're just not sure we should invest in that. And I'm proud that I said, God, yes, grab it. And in the years since, at that time, the wisdom that I saw was in comparison to Movable Type, which, because it saw a conflict of interest in what it was doing, that others who ran Movable Type instances as businesses, Movable Type didn't want them to compete too much, so they throttled it. You, on the other hand, had a completely different model, not to tell you what you will explain better than I can, but by having the open source base and then building WordPress.com as the commercial end on top of that, you enabled this huge growth. You enabled the contributions to that open source base. And you, in essence, almost created a foundation for creation on the net. And so here's what I argued, is that if we look at, let's say, Twitter, and since we had that show, Jack Dorsey has said most recently that their mistake was making Twitter a company, and that he wishes that Twitter were a protocol. And I'm very excited about what I see maybe coming with Blue Sky, which we talked about a lot, which strikes me as similar, that you end up with a distributed open source base of speech in that case. And then people can build enterprises on top of that. You can, others, as you demonstrated, others can too, and many can succeed. And the internet is not then in the control of a few corporations, for good and bad, in terms of outsiders trying to get them to control the internet in turn, governments and so on. So it really struck me that you had long ago the model, and maybe it was just the model of the internet, but you had a model for how to build out the infrastructure of the net. And so I'm really eager to hear your reaction to what's happened since and what should come next. If you're building the next Twitter, if you're building the next something, how do they follow your example?
And that's a big topic. we mentioned Stuart Brand earlier, another guy I look up to a lot is Kevin Kelly. He has a book called What Technology Wants. And I'm a big believer in kind of this idea of adjacent possibilities. So that, the world wants something to exist. The progress of technological humanity, culture, the culture. Me and Mike didn't make WordPress, I feel like someone else would have made something like it with a different name, because the world needed an open source operating system for this, website layer. And I see that happening other places now. So one of the projects I'm actually most excited about recently is Stable Diffusion. Are y'all familiar with this?
Oh, are we excited about that? Yeah, this is the AI. And by the way, open source, so you can run it on your own software, art generator. Really fantastic. We've been playing with
phenomenal
it.
Yeah. Stuff being done. Yeah.
Yeah. So this idea that, the work OpenAI is doing is, I think, some of the most interesting in the world. And gosh, I would not have predicted that you could type things in and get just such incredible art, photographs, right. Everything back from DALL-E, I think is how you pronounce it.
Yep.
And then, but the world kind of wants an open source version of that too. And just out of left field, this Stability AI company came and released Stable Diffusion. And now there's a package you can run it on your Mac and generate images in 20, 30 seconds. It's pretty special to look at what's generated. In terms of the news, I saw that a generated image actually won an art contest.
Yes, yeah.
Recently,
yeah,
in Colorado,
Ben Thompson at Stratechery started using. I think he's using Midjourney to do some of the illustration. We talked in our editorial conference yesterday. You'll be interested to know, Matt, about using Stable Diffusion for our thumbnails for the podcast. And I've already said, we got to get we got to set up a server in here so we can be running it. So you can start with the photographic, thumbnail that we're going to use and run it through Stable Diffusion and get some interesting variety on that. It's amazing, though. That's like 3 or 4 weeks ago that they released that. And it's a Cambrian explosion of creativity.
Because it's open, right, Matt? I mean, that's what makes it possible.
Well, and that's what, and cool stuff happens in proprietary companies all the time. I would say that the way Automatic and myself have done things is definitely a lot more complicated. It's a lot more work to have a foundation and open source, and you can get WordPress from Bluehost, or you can get WordPress from us, or it's a lot more complicated than if you just type in, say, Shopify, and you go to Shopify. There's only one place to get it. But I think that you use the word Cambrian explosion. I think that's a great analogy. The evolution that can happen when people can really dig into the engine, see how it works, modify it, customize it, and have complete freedom in how they choose to run it is really powerful. And that's what I want to see more of in the world, and certainly more of on the net. And so that's what myself and merry band of 2000 friends and colleagues are working on creating more of.
When you started building Automatic, I think about how I did Twit, which is initially was scratching an itch. I was a radio broadcaster, and radio didn't look like it had much of a future. I thought, I bet we could do this less expensively on our own. And then it just kind of seemed to fall in place, which I think is that feeling of, yeah, the universe is ready for this. But I didn't have a great strategic plan. It was more like a random walk. Did you think at the beginning what you wanted to do with Automattic, or was it more that random walk?
If I'm honest, in the beginning, I was just hoping that we could figure out a way for myself and a few buddies to get paid for doing what we were doing for fun, which was writing code for WordPress.
Yeah, because you loved it.
Nothing wrong with that.
And far beyond any monetary needs, like, this is fun for me. It's what I want to do.
Right.
It's what I hope to spend the rest of my life doing.
I think it's best if it starts that way instead of, oh, I'm going to make $1 million. How can I do that?
It was more like, how can I make enough to keep doing it?
Yeah, exactly.
But then came the point, Matt, where you did have to go to the
jazz musician, and jazz musicians in Houston particularly have a long history of having a day gig. You know, maybe they teach I saw someone the other day. He's a researcher at a university. Like, you know, they do things during the day, and then at night they come together, make their music, practice their craft.
Then there's a whole culture of people wanting to just start something to get the big buyout down the road.
Yeah, I don't like that.
I'm assuming that was
heading for the exit,
minds,
right? Yeah.
Though, if you'd like to buy Twitter,
if I'm honest, I thought that would happen. Like, that's, I think, one of my friends was journalist Owen Malik, and he was if you do this, Yahoo will probably buy you in a few years. And I thought, well, that'd be great. But then once it got going, I was like, wow, I think we could actually build something. And
Ohm's kicking himself.
I had a ton of money. I would want to be doing exactly what we're doing. So let's just let's keep it rolling and see what we can create as an independent company, which is what we've been doing for the past. I guess so. Automattic started in 2005, so 17 years now.
Have you followed Blue Sky and Jack's vision for that? Do you have any opinions about that as a
Twitter's
as a protocol direction?
Vision for a federated kind of open Twitter.
I haven't looked into the technology of it. I will say that publishing is complicated. Like, Jeff, you know this in journalism. Like, right. I actually have begun, as I've aged, to appreciate the malleability of our systems, why we have a court system, why we have laws, why we elect people, like this whole process that we're trying to enshrine into code with things like blockchain and contracts and tokens. When we make it too inflexible, or it ossifies the vision of how it was supposed to work when it started. And I think one of the beautiful things about human systems, like this experiment of American democracy, still ongoing, is the malleability. Now, of course, sometimes you find the cracks in that, but also that it can evolve over time. So I really appreciate the more human-driven projects with a room for error.
Of course, you started Automattic and created WordPress at the height of blogging popularity, but it's kind of gone through a winter since. And yet you've survived. How did you do that?
You know, I'm never sure what the temperature is. People are always saying blogging is at the height or dying. It felt like we were pretty late, actually, because there were dozens and dozens of blogging systems.
Lots of platforms.
Available.
Yeah.
Blogger had already been bought by Google.
Right.
By the time we started, Dave Weiner had been doing it for 8 or 9 years, with scripting.com. And so y'all should get him on. Actually,
oh, we love Dave. He's probably listening right now. He's
awesome.
Yeah, Dave is such a pioneer.
And also, what I love about Dave, and part of his inspiration to me, was doing it in public, right? So, your thinking, share what you're learning, share your mistakes, share the code you learned, share the project you came across. He has this incredible archive now going back. I forget when he started, it was in the 90s, I think. Of his kind of daily thoughts and my blog. I'm not blogging as much as I want to or used to, but it's really neat to be able to go into those archives and see, what I come across. It's the number one reason I think people should journal a blog. And I know that that's part of why we bought Day One, is because journaling, Day One is basically local encrypted blogging, for journaling. Publishing does have an additional, what do you call it? Risk or something. Like people are more worried to publish than ever because you can have mobs, you can be attacked. If you mess up, you can get in trouble. But, it is also where the most beauty comes from, I think.
That's one way the blogging has changed. The world has changed. You know, a lot of blogs no longer use comments because that's a place you can get rolled. I think the advent of Twitter, I'll speak for myself, but I think a lot of people stopped blogging long
before. Ruined me.
Yeah, it ruined us for blogs.
I could get rid of a thought.
140 like character blogs. Right.
Yeah. Twitter now has Twitter notes too, right? The long form.
Yeah.
You think, and of course, and then Ev went off and did Medium. And I mean, so there is, I think long form, I like long form, but I think it also looks, maybe we're just reading the temperature wrong, but it looks like people aren't willing to spend that much time reading anymore.
Do you think long form is a generational kind of thing?
Yeah.
Because everything is such a short attention span nowadays. I still think long form has a place. I mean, we still have mediums and stuff like
people
that.
People still subscribe to the New Yorker like for some reason, but
right. But I wonder if that's just a generational gap now. You know,
yeah.
Part of why we bought Long Reads and run a magazine called Atavist as well, which only publishes once per month, super long pieces, usually 15,000-20,000 words or more. So I mean, when the forums first came out, people were like, no one's going to create on this. No one's going to spend time on this. But it turns out, like, especially as the screens got better, we're always connected. There's a lot of found time. And so people do read. I would say there's probably more reading happening now than ever before.
Hmm.
Video is enticing, right? We're doing it now. Some people are watching this right now instead of reading. So the live interaction, short form videos, TikTok, obviously very compelling. But there's something that sort of ignites your imagination when you read that isn't replicable in any other medium, at least that I've experienced.
I'm not turning this into a plug, but I have a book coming out next year called The Gutenberg Parenthesis. And so we share an idol in that name. And at the end of it, I say that I was wrong to think that the book as a form should be updated. Let the book be the book. However, as I've thought about other forms of media, I think the other forms of media are largely evanescent, that magazines have their time, and then many go away. That's not to say there aren't thousands of magazines
A lot of books are ephemeral as well. I mean, let's face it.
Right, but as a form, I'm starting to wonder about the magazine as a form. The newspaper as a form
is
not economically viable anymore, to put it in print.
Like and physically, so, you mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, exactly. So I think we tie ourselves too much with presumptions of old forms. And I still love the book and I still love reading books and I have many around me. And I think it will continue. But I think that we go to other forms. The magazine was started, in the U.S. They started taking off in 1850 with steam-powered presses. The newspaper, similarly with steam-powered presses, we got to that mechanization and scale. So I guess it's my long preamble to a question about people probably presume that in WordPress, people are making, to use old terms, articles or stories or things like that. What are the exciting uses of the tool you've created that you see to go beyond what we knew?
Yeah, there's an interesting tension right now in the WordPress community because there is, and about actually half the signups we get to WordPress.com are bloggers. So people blogging. As that is traditionally understood. And then the other half is people building websites on it.
The White House was on WordPress for a long time.
WhiteHouse.gov. It is today.
It still is.
WhiteHouse.gov.
Okay.
And we're actually running that infrastructure, knock on wood. they switched over to our, we have this enterprise service called WP VIP, which is basically like bulletproof WordPress. Like we can rail it, scale it, anything. And that switched right before the Ukraine war started. So all the Kremlin sites went down. White House stayed up. I was very happy. To kind of your original question, though, actually, I lost it. What was the question?
Well, just kind of what I'll do another.
Well, let me just try for one second.
The essay and the novel and the newspaper were invented a century and a half after movable type. And it was then people said, oh, wow, what can I do with this thing? So I wonder, since you watch the WordPress ecosystem, what you're seeing about creation with it that's exciting you, or that you see glimmers of a future that goes beyond the analogs we know of magazines and newspapers and so on.
Question. So what I'm trying to do, actually, funnily enough, with our new version of the editor is called Gutenberg.
Yes, so I use it every day.
Sharing the shared idol. It was actually really neat at the WordCamp. I just went to, some people brought me some gifts from the Gutenberg Museum, which was really neat. I've never visited there, so I definitely
You should go. You must go. You must go.
What I'm trying to do is, right now, social networks in particular are forcing people into very generic forms. You know, you can't have really expressive layouts or be weird. You know, they kind of make all the profiles look the same. It's very much like a, I don't know, it feels like a Soviet housing block sometimes. People do interesting stuff inside the box, but I want to make it a lot easier for people to do outside the box layout, design, content creation, and build both sides of it. So with Gutenberg, we have the editor that allows you to create like really rich widgets, embed maps, layouts, you know, put things left and right. And actually, I just talked to or DM'd with Dave Weiner about this the other day, is I want to do a reader as well that supports these rich formats.
Yes,
so that you can have, you can follow things and actually
and
read it in,
like,
as the creator intended.
The creator not being the man upstairs, but the person who created it. But you also own Tumblr, which is interesting because Tumblr was created almost as an anti-WordPress, where it's more like the original blogs, Tumblogs, you know. And I don't know. I can't remember. Did David Karp create Tumblr before WordPress, or did you create it after WordPress, or WordPress after
it
Tumblr?
It started a little later, maybe 2007, 2008. Tumblr was our very best competitor.
Yeah, because it was so easy to create.
It was
a blog.
Different too.
Yeah, and it was very quick hit, as you still is, which is interesting. I'm really glad you acquired it because I think it was not in good hands, and I really think it's an important platform for somebody who doesn't want to spend.
I almost don't want to tell people about it. Like, we're having so much fun on Tumblr right now. Like, it's actually quite fun to use. It's my favorite social network by far, and I really like Twitter. It's a very generative space. You know, it's all about art and artists.
Mm-hmm, right.
And so you can just go there and kind of put on different identities. It's almost like the Burning Man of social networks. you can really kind of be free when you're on Tumblr.
Right.
Matt, what do you think about the state of the net? We just had legislation stopped for now in the Senate. Protection is for newspapers. We see the California regulations that are going to be very complicated. We all read Mike Masnick here, and he takes us through the complications. There's a lot of moral panic about the state of the net. What's your prescription for where it is?
I guess this also brings us back to ask about Blue Sky. You know, running a social network and running internet is really, really, really hard. So remember, I refer to that, you know, it's nice to have the human systems built in. You know, one of the things we did put a ton of effort into Tumblr once we bought it was cleaning it up. You know, there was a lot of hate speech on there. There's a lot of kids, you know, talking about self-harm or drugs or other things. And like, you can't, you need to garden the space. You need to curate it to create a healthy space. And the tension between that and the legality of freedom of speech, and also like the popular understanding of freedom of speech, is kind of a beautiful tension. And I think that we're always going to have companies in there and organizations. I don't think we'll ever have a technical solution to this because it's fundamentally a human problem.
Mm-hmm. What on that point, I know it's still controversial about Tumblr because some people want to do certain things that aren't legit there now. But I do salute you because I think that, yes, we have to invest in those spaces. And if we abandon them or leave it to others, then we know what's going to happen. We can know that well. What was the investment? What was the investment at the beginning? What's the ongoing investment just in terms of scale of effort to keep Tumblr sociable and usable and nice?
Yeah. So our big push right now is to get Tumblr to break even because it's burning $40 or $50 million per year.
Yikes.
And it's cost to run above what it makes. And
because of this kind of
that's
social
why we've been
effort.
Launching some subscriptions, some products where users can like blaze their posts to promote it. Just different things to try to get it to break even. But it is growing. It is really popular, especially with youth in America. And so I think there's a real potential there. But gosh, I have so much empathy for the Dorseys and Zuckerbergs of the world. Running a social network is darn hard.
Yeah, I mean, I can see why you almost don't want to tell people about Tumblr because if the masses invade, then that doubles, you know, quadruples.
Or exploit.
Yeah, your problems with it. How do you make money? Is there advertising or is it a paid subscription?
Yeah, so we have ads on Tumblr. I would say, you know, advertising is the default social media business model. So we have that as a base layer. But what we're trying to do is create something new on top of it. So we have an upgrade to turn off the ads. We have upgrades where users can promote their own things. So you can pay, you know, $20 and put a picture of your cat in front of 100,000 people. you can, there's upgrades to for fun stuff, like to put these dancing crabs on your dashboard. so we're trying to, and we're selling like actual physical goods. The most popular being shoelaces, actually, because there's a longstanding
Tumblr
meme on Tumblr
shoelaces.
About like,
what?
You ask about the shoelaces and you say, oh, I stole them from the president or something. And the shoelaces, we have not been able to keep them on the shelf. So for a combination of like merchandise, retail, digital goods, physical goods, we are, really grinding to get Tumblr back into profitability.
So I'm going to pay for it now. $5 a month or $40 a year. I'm paying for it.
Right now?
You need a little chime in your office. I had a real soft spot for Tumblr. And the reason I brought it up is because it is kind of, I also have a WordPress account. I also have a blog. I actually have a self-hosted static blog on Hugo. I've gone through so many blogging platforms, but I never write anymore, and I feel like Tumblr is kind of the antithesis of the long form. It's like just it's fun, it's quick, it's a lot more in a way like Reddit. I want to see Tumblr succeed. I'm so glad you guys bought it.
So less of a treadmill than Instagram too.
Right.
I've got to get more. I've got to be bigger. What I love about blogs so much is that it's the ability to have my place. And the ability to use that however you want then rather than, and I like social media. I love Twitter. I deal with Facebook, but there's what I miss about blogging. And I teach students this every year is it was that first moment when I had a blog post and somebody linked to me and I linked back to them and I said, it's a conversation.
Yeah.
And somebody else used their space to talk with me, and I use my space to talk with them, and that changed my entire view of media, my entire view of journalism, my career, my life, everything was the link in the blog.
Well, that
and
yes,
it's still here.
To that end, I mean, we used to have all of that. How do you feel about web mentions, web hooks, things like that? Some of the newer stuff that people like Kevin Marks are doing.
Love it.
Yeah.
Kevin Marks, Tontek Chelik, Simon Willison. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Eric Meyer, these sort of web builders are good folks to follow to see what could be around the corner. Alex Russell, another good person to follow.
Because that's what we want to get back to is this kind of community, right? No matter what platform you're using.
I actually have a big project for it, working on the rest of the year, is to see what we can do to reinvigorate comments.
As I said, a lot of people have turned off comments. Because,
so what do you think that takes then? To do it well.
I think there's two things. One, you need to have a really smooth flow for like logging and commenting. I love that WordPress has moderation by default so that it's a curated space. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end, you need the feedback loop. So notifications. So knowing when notifying the blogger when someone comments, notifying the commenter when someone replies to their comment, you know, that you just have to close that whole interaction loop. And I think it could be pretty exciting because if you look at what's happening on like Discord, Reddit, like so much on the web, people want to talk to each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not really happy with Facebook. There needs to be a better way than Facebook, is I guess what I'm saying.
You're being
very diplomatic, Matt, so I won't press
that. I actually like Facebook.
Yeah, okay, all right. Yeah. There you go.
All right, there's one among us.
Facebook ads have gotten so good. They are hyper-targeting me now. It's, like, scary. It's, like, the exact artists that I like, they're promoting the art to me, and like they know I can spend more, and like, so it's actually like expensive. Like, it's kind of crazy how
I had to stop doing Instagram. I'd spend money every night about 4 a.m. I'd look at Instagram and buy whatever the first thing was that I saw. I was completely vulnerable. I was completely vulnerable to it. So
you mentioned Tumblr being a social network. I never really saw it as a social network. I just see it as a platform, but everything you're describing sounds just like a social network. Do you feel like Tumblr is in competition with the likes of Twitter or Facebook and working to try to draw more people in? Or do you just feel like, okay, we're still just a platform where people can create content regardless of whatever is going on in the social media space?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's actually kind of orders of magnitude. So like Facebook's 3 billion, Twitter's 300 million, Tumblr's like 30 million. So it's like 1/10 the size of Twitter, but with like 1/80th or something, the number of employees is 200 people working on Tumblr right now. Right. It's totally a social network. And the thing is, it's a social network that you really have to work at for it to be good. Uh-huh. So that's what we're trying to fix, because if you just sign up for it, you really have to curate who you're following and follow tags and kind of prune things. And it takes a little bit to learn how to use. But then once you become a pro user, I think one of the stats we track is like how many people log in 6 out of 7 days. We have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of folks who are like really totally into the service and super power users of it.
That's why I think it's web mentions and all that are very important, because there, you know, the internet's like space. It's big, really big. And there's plenty of room for all of this. But you don't want silos. You'd like I like the Fediverse. I like Mastodon, because you'd like some porosity in these things so that, you know, people who use Tumblr can interact with people who use Facebook, can interact with people who use Twitter. I feel like that's what people want, but it's not what corporations want. How can we make it more what people want?
I think people are very quick to trade off freedom for convenience.
Yeah.
So I think the challenge to all of us who are trying to create this more open, federated, democratic, free web is to make the user experience so compelling that people will choose it. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to care about the plumbing underneath being free or not free. But if we can make the free version better, then I think we'll win. And that was really the thing I realized very early on, because I kind of started off being like, oh, I'm just going to preach open source. And once people understand open source, they will definitely choose WordPress.
Yeah, it'll be obvious.
And then I very quickly learned, like, no, they don't really care. Like, they say, you don't want a drill, you want a hole in the wall. Like, they're just trying to solve some problem. They're trying to have a presence on the web. Ooh. That's not even the problem. They're probably trying to get more people in their restaurants or more like readers to their writing or something. And so I was like, well, if we want the web to be more open, we're going to have to get really, really good at making user experience. So that's been our focus, still is today.
You're still a open source.
100%.
Yeah. Promoter. Yeah. Good. Because I think really
open source is really my life's work. That is the thing that will. Yeah.
That's the model.
It feels like, you know, we're stewarding this for the next generation. Like, while I'm alive and able to type and my mind works, I'm going to try to build as much open source stuff as possible. And that'll pass on to the next generation. And that's, I think, what's accelerating humanity's progress.
God's work, sir. God's work.
I completely agree. Yeah.
I'm curious what, because you've always had interesting interests. Besides making as much open source as you can and running tons of companies and working on all this, what are your interests outside of Automattic these days? What are you following? I'm just curious personally what you like to.
You know, we just had a really fun thing at Burning Man that I helped fund, It's called the Sonic Sphere. So there's this crazy guy I know. He has actually founded a company called Memrise. His name's Ed Cook. And he was reading an old book and came across the concept of what's called a Kugel auditorium, K-U-G-E-L. And the idea is that it's a 360-degree sphere of sound. So there's speakers all around you. And, you know, the team actually built this at Burning Man. So what you could do is you could climb up to it. It was like maybe 15, 20 meters tall. There'd be a net inside, this kind of like buckyball-looking structure. Kind of like that. There you go. There's some early prototypes. If you scroll down, maybe they'll have the Burning Man one. These are all the different prototypes they built. Oh, yeah, there it is.
Which one?
They don't have the photo yet. The one on the right.
This is what they built.
What they ended up building.
Oh.
And so you'd be suspended in this net.
Oh, my God. And, how awesome.
What?
So you're in the middle of it.
Individually addressable the, speakers. There,
this is
and
this.
So sound would literally move around you.
Wow.
And they had all sorts of different sonic experiences. So there was... they had one where you were like the Apollo 11 launch, the audio from that.
Cool.
Different music, some music that had been composed specifically for this. It's essentially like an instrument, these 52 speakers.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing experience. And also just to see, you know, the team that worked on that, really, it was their life for half the year, you know, to bring it together. And then for it to exist for that, you know, week and a half at Burning Man was pretty special. So that's really fun. Just art, you know, you got to feed your soul as well. Yeah. I just went to the Rothko Chapel earlier. If you're ever in Houston or passing through, highly, highly recommended. It's a, you know, Mark Rothko, the color field painter.
Oh, yeah.
One of his last works was this purpose built space, 17 Rothko paintings on the walls, open every single day of the year, 9 to 5, free admission. You just walk in and it's kind of like a meditative space. It's just these paintings surround you, kind of like an octagon, and there's some benches and cushions in the middle, and nothing like it anywhere else in the world.
There's been a place in San Francisco. I always think of it as an old hippie place called the Audium, which is sort of a similar idea.
That's so good. Yeah.
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 Yes, it's been...
Audium, I think, still runs on tapes.
Like, it's wouldn't be surprised.
Like, really old school.
It's from the 50s. I think they built it in 1967, but the it's still there in San Francisco. You can still go.
So I need to ask
Beth. I kind of want to hook up the Audium folks with the Sonic Sphere folks.
Feels like it, yeah.
Or, you know, the musician who I would love to play this instrument is Jacob Collier. I don't know if y'all follow him at all. I think he's probably the one of the greatest musicians alive right now. Just otherworldly. And he started as like a YouTube.
Yeah, he does it on YouTube.
Record every single track.
Yeah.
Check out his, Don't You Worry About a Thing cover.
Yeah.
The Stevie Wonder cover.
Yeah. If he
and,
doesn't
you know,
take us down, I'll play
like
a little bit of it. He's one of these guys on YouTube who, you know, just overdubs until you get this amazing chorus environment where it's all him.
Yeah,
we were talking about this some time ago. Yeah, I love JP.
Yeah.
Wouldn't he be amazing on that sphere?
Oh.
Right.
He posts some videos that are, even if you're not a musician, just fascinating to watch. He did a recording of Moon River that has literally hundreds of individual tracks.
Yeah.
And he walks through showing how he built it and, like, you know, just screen sharing his kind of audio thing. And it's just, it's fun to see a creator, like someone in their element at the top of the game, one of the best in the world, sharing their passion. And so actually showing how the sausage gets made is pretty incredible. Yeah. I think I watched like 2 hours of this, even though I'm never going to like do what he does. I was just like so fascinated.
You give me a lot of hope, Matt, because, and Jeff and I are old hippies. And this was what we had hoped the world would be like. And in fact, even at the beginning of the internet, this is what we hoped the internet would bring us. And sometimes, I don't know about you, Jeff, but I get discouraged by, you know, the most obvious surface of the internet. But it's great. Thank you, Matt, for reminding me that amongst all that, there are plenty of people like Jacob Collier who are using these media to do amazing things. maybe more than ever before, but there's just so much of it now, it's easy to be fooled.
That's where all the hope is, Leo. It is. I'm saying it again, 150 years after Movable Type, after Gutenberg, to come up with the novel with Cervantes and the essay with Montaigne and the newspaper and the printed market for plays. There's so much that can be done. Clay Shirky says that the tools don't become interesting until they become boring. People accept them, they know what they are, and then the question becomes not the tool, but what you do with it.
Well, and
that's what I see exciting about everything.
And history and time have a way of separating the wheat from the chaff. There probably was just as much chaff.
Oh, witchcraft.
A lot of crap out there. But the stuff that survived is amazing, you know, is the Sistine Chapel. And so, you know, we're in the midst of all of it. And
culture is what you remember.
Yeah.
And that's where it is.
That's a good way.
Matt, I've got to ask you, since you art, one word reaction, NFT. What's your reaction?
He's too political and diplomatic to say anything bad.
I'm trying.
Are you? Let me ask you this: are you making the Web3 version of WordPress?
We do have someone in Automattic who is working on, you know, just focused on creating bridges between WordPress and Web3 stuff and WooCommerce. You know, we have this open source Shopify WooCommerce that's doing quite well. I think 30 billion of transactions last year.
Wow.
Went through WooCommerce.
Wow. That's amazing. Wow.
You know, I think it's a distorted market. So, you know, markets are free and open, but we forget how easy it is to distort them. So if you look at basically the impact of one actor, which is like Saudi Arabia plus SoftBank, on technology over the past 5 years and valuations and everything like that, it completely distorted this market. So, you know, we have this myth of efficient markets in reality. And I think the distortion in the crypto market is, one, you had such incredible riches created for the early adopters, you know, people with thousands of Bitcoins or Ethereum. And they, to, you know, essentially sustain their original lottery ticket, will put money into every single thing that could be, they'll invest into everything that's on the network. And so that distorts the economics a little bit. The other thing is that because you had this such rapid accumulation of wealth, both in paper and in reality, there is this kind of this distortion where if you're creating something in the crypto space, I think it's tough to know whether you truly have product market fit, like you've created something that users really resonate with, or if people are, you know, trying to get in early on the token so it goes up, and like whether you have like long-term investors or short-term investors, essentially people looking to make a quick buck or who are really actually using your product and service. And I guess this goes all the way back to Blue Sky. Like, what was that crypto Twitter thing? They ranked everyone and you could buy and sell tokens for everyone you followed.
Yeah, that was short-lived, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I remember we talked about it and then it was gone.
I think it's still there. And they built a distributed Twitter. Like, that was kind of
interesting.
The cool thing about it.
Okay.
But there's a... Yeah. They... I think it shows... I don't know what that shows. I think it shows that just because something like the tokens got super valuable or you get a huge run-up, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have the long-term usage that is ultimately the lifeblood of any product.
What are you looking, what frontiers are next for you? The next open source you want to build, the next things you want to play with, exploit?
I guess I should also say that I'm super into all the crypto stuff as well. Like, technology.
Stipulated, Your Honor.
And particularly like zero knowledge proofs, Zcash, Monero, the stuff that's happening with Ethereum. I think it's some of the most interesting open source in the world that's happening right now. And so I can't wait to see what it does. I just, I don't think, kind of like this whole metaverse stuff, like I feel like sometimes people try to create a trend where there isn't one. And we should just, you know, actually look at what's being used.
Yeah.
What am I excited about? I'm really excited about, you know, creating more canvas and paintbrushes and colors for people to paint with.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Bravo.
That's really, you know, the calling of folks at Automattic is we make the tools, and it's so rewarding to see what people do with it.
Do you get to code? Included. Do you get to code anymore, Matt? Or?
A little bit, yeah.
Nice.
I can be dangerous every now and then.
Nice.
It was actually one of my big regrets was prior to Burning Man, I was hoping to do some LED programming for the Sonic Sphere, and I just wasn't able to get to it because there was so much work to take that week off. I had to do a ton of work beforehand, and we had a board meeting right after, so I wasn't able to get to it. But if I had like a few months off, I think probably what I'd play with is I think LED programming, actually.
And you're probably really not doing that in PHP, I'm thinking.
What's that?
Not doing that in PHP, I'm thinking.
No, there's a lot of some cool open source stuff there.
What do you do? Well. What do you code in when you get a chance?
Oh, I actually write a lot of weird stuff in PHP. Like all of my email actually runs through a PHP script, kind of a WordPress plugin, actually. It all gets piped to that. It classifies it based on whether I emailed the person, how they're set in a database and everything. That's part of how my email system works. Do some scripting. I really love like systems administration. I love networking, you know, Unify stuff.
Awesome.
Ubiquity.
Yeah.
It's just so much fun to play with. And they've got their access control now. So you can have the NFC cards, the cameras, the everything. Like that stuff's really fun.
I actually been planning to do that. I have a Ubiquity house. I've been thinking about doing
Ubiquity house.
Yeah.
I'm kind of enjoying the realm of technology, moving from bits to atoms.
I
definitely appreciate being in the bit world where, you know, you can copy things instantly. There's abundance and everything. But I like, as technology is starting to bleed into the real world and just improve it, just little things like, can you walk in the room and the lights turn on? And is it a pleasing color and tone? And like home, what's it called? Home Assistant is the open source home automation thing. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Matt Mullenweg is at Photomat on Twitter. I guess that's probably the best place to keep up with what's going on with you.
Tumblr.
Oh, what am I saying? What's your Tumblr? What's your Tumblr? Is it Photomat?
Yeah, of course.
All right, I'm gonna. I
do tweet a lot.
I gotta follow you. I'm not following you.
Yeah, on the web is my blog.
Yeah, there you go, Matt on Tumblr.
Oh, thank you for following me.
Yeah, well, of course. Now that I'm paying for Tumblr, I gotta follow somebody. By the way, I said AT&T was Verizon was the evil empire that acquired Tumblr. Let's get.
It was Yahoo, which then merged with AOL
and then became.
And then Verizon bought
such a nightmare.
Which was the Verizon,
and all that
was
stuff.
The Yahoo AOL thing, and that became Verizon Media. And I think they spun it back out again. It's now like another company.
Yes. Oh, it's ridiculous.
But
Matt, can I take you back to the beginning just for 1 second? Because I'm always curious. After I spoke with Polaris, they ended up investing in you. What were the conversations like with those first investors when you needed the capital and went for it, and you were such a different way to do things? How did that work to convince them this was a wise way?
Man, it was a strong filter. So, you know, most investors said no. Also, remember, I was a little pipsqueak. I was like 20 years old. I couldn't even drink. And I wanted to create a virtual currency. I wanted to do all these sorts of things. So I had very, very broad ambitions. And that just filtered out a lot of people. And, but the ones who ended up investing, you know, I think could understand the broader vision. And one really nice thing we've been able to do as Automattic is now a longer tenured company is, you know, we take our fiduciary responsibility to shareholders very seriously. So over the years, we've been able to, essentially bring in new investors to buy out old investors. If for whatever reason, for example, I don't think Polaris owns any Automattic stock anymore. Mm-hmm. Whatever their timeline or their, you know, when they invested in Automattic, I think the valuation was $3 or $4 million. They put in like a 1.1 on a 3.3 was the round or Series A. So, you know, at that point, when you grow revenue and everything like that, like they can have an amazing return. And the new investors can come in and say, wow, you're going to grow at this compound annual growth rate for the past 5 years. And looks like you're going to do it for the next 5 years. Sign me up for that. So there's just different classes of investors, and it's all about finding the right partners.
Well, I wish you nothing but the best. You've been such a boon to everybody who wants to publish or create on the internet. Your portfolio of companies shows that. You've saved some of the best companies in the world from a fate worse than death. You created, I think, the best blogging platform ever.
We're trying to make a Berkshire Hathaway of the internet.
Yeah, I like it.
Wow, nice.
We'll call you the wizard of, where do you live?
Houston.
Wizard of Houston. All right, I like it. Matt, thank you for spending some time
with
us.
Thank you so much, Matt. Thank you for everything.
Enough. I think anybody who's watching.
It's really great to see you all.
Yeah.
And don't be a stranger. Happy to come on anytime.
Okay.
And
I'll take you up
on the rest of the
watch
show.
Out.
I'm a big Pixelbook fan.
Okay.
I bought my mom a Pixelbook. I love Pixelbook.
You can watch Jeff Moore.
I'm so sad.
You can watch Jeff
Moore. I'm so sad, Matt.
Really appreciate your time. Matt Mullenweg, Photo Matt on Twitter, on Tumblr, Automatic, and WordPress.com. A legend and such a nice young man. Such a clean-cut, nice young man. Thank you, Matt. I appreciate
your
time. It's great to see you. Thank you, Jeff, for suggesting.
Oh, thank you for doing that. That was just such a pleasure. An honor to be able to talk to Matt. I just think the world of him. So
yeah.
I'm really grateful for
that. Truly, you know, for a mogul, he's pretty sweet.
Oh, he's amazing.
Right?
He's pretty nice.
He's so soft-spoken. So
I know.
I didn't sense much jackassery in him at all.
No, very little.
No, not a bit. Not a molecule. Not a hair.
All
nope.
right. Get your candle back. We're gonna do a little mourning when we come back. As I mentioned, Stacey has a week off. Now that I know Matt's into home automation, now I really regret it that Stacey
I know that she
here.
Wasn't here. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Wow. Right. Would they have had a conversation? But maybe next, we'll bring him back. We'll bring him back. You know, it'd be fun. And maybe you do this with me, Jeff. Not necessarily Twig, but a special show with maybe Dave Weiner. And
oh,
Matt.
Yes. Yes.
I know you want to get David Weinberger on.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
Just some of the heroes of the early days of open source and the internet who are still doing amazing things.
And the funny thing is Matt is a hero of the early days of the internet. He's still young.
He's a kid. Well, he started when he was 19.
Yeah.
I mean.
Like Dave Karp.
Yeah. Yeah. Our show today brought to you by IRL, which is an original podcast from Mozilla. You know what IRL stands for in real life. But this is interesting because it's a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policy. Bridget Todd does such a good job hosting it. And there's a new season. This season, IRL looks at AI in real life. Who can AI help? Who can it harm? We really are, as we were talking about, going through a Cambrian explosion with AI right now. This is the time to start thinking about what it means. Season 6 of IRL features fascinating conversations with people who are working to build more trustworthy AI. For example, there's an episode about how the world is being mapped with AI. The data that's missing from those maps tells as much of a story as the maps themselves. You hear all about the people who are working to fill in those gaps and take control of the data. There's another episode about gig workers who use apps for their livelihood and how they're pushing back against algorithms that control everything, how much they're paid. They're looking for new ways to gain power over data to create better working conditions. For political junkies, there's an episode about the role AI plays when it comes to the spread of misinformation and hate speech around elections. Obviously, that's a big concern right now. It's a really interesting show about one of the most important topics in technology today. IRL, hosted by Bridget Todd. It's from Mozilla, and you can find it by just going to our show notes. We'll put a link there, or search for IRL in your podcast player. Use Pocket Casts. That's Matt's podcast player. Great one, too. We thank IRL so much for their support of This Week in Google. IRL, who has power over AI? That's the question. Who? I think about Instagram and I think about Flickr and all the places I want to post photos. I want to hang with people. There's just so many places. We have our own social networks. We have the Twit community and the Twit Mastodon, but it all feels very fragmented. I think that's one thing we would like to do a show about maybe is the open web. Kevin's, whenever he's on, talks a lot about that, of course, but I feel like there's a solution there somewhere. Maybe it lies in open source.
When I taught a course last term with Doug Rushkoff, who I think
Douglas,
for his mother's sake. So Douglas Rushkoff, we taught a course in redesigning the internet, and one of the big lessons to me was that the students who were master's students, they're a little bit older, but they all came on the internet, they came alive in the internet when it was already corporate. It was already past those early heady hopeful days that we had. And what I love too is to try to recap. And we can't. There were mistakes made in the early net, in the early web. We were too optimistic. We didn't build in guardrails. We didn't think of the impact. All that's true. But there was also, I want to recapture what that notion of hope was. And for Matt at the end to say, he just wants to make canvases and paintbrushes for people, and to have the faith in that creativity is exactly what we want to recapture. And the same with Dave Weiner. I mean, Dave, I love how much Matt respects Dave and stays in touch with Dave and takes advice from Dave, because Dave is always generous to give it and has a vision and has ideas. And that's wonderful. But, you know, his vision for the early web. And then you go to like David Weinberger, and philosophically, he had a philosophical perspective on what it could be and what it shouldn't be that he's had in his books since. And I don't want to just go to the old farts, and I'll include Matt in the old fart list right now, but I think there is something to learn from playing the tape back and asking what we did right and wrong. We put myself in it broadly. I didn't do anything, but you know, the early days of the net, what hopes were right, what hopes have been lost, what hopes can be recaptured. I think that's so important now.
Yeah, I mean, you might say, oh, you know, Matt's just a wide-eyed optimist, or maybe you're a wide-eyed optimist. I don't know.
I'm accused of that often.
But I think that if we don't do that, then we are stuck with the dystopia.
Then we'll never get anything that's slightly less worse than what we have.
Yeah. All right, Jeff, light the candle, put on the hood. It's time to mourn. Now, I should point out that this is a rumor. This is, and consider the source, the most ugly website you've ever seen, the Verge. Did you see the new Verge?
They just redesigned.
What the hell is this? Okay.
Hey, we said that about the first version of it too, though. So
yeah, I guess.
You know, this is one hell of a logo. the shtick is it's the incomplete internet, the incomplete logo. So I kind of like that
is
idea.
Is that
the
what they say?
They have a whole page. I put it in the rundown. Yeah. But you never look at my part of the rundown anymore.
I haven't gotten there yet. But no,
there's a line 67 is their design.
Oh, look, something later went wrong.
Oh, no.
This isn't your link. I'm clicking the link on their site. Neil Patel's article. Welcome to the New Verge.
Oh, whoops. What's wrong with that script?
Whoops.
See if line.
Well, it's a redesign. That's okay. But
yeah, that's all it is.
I don't understand the thinking behind this at all. And the other thing I wanted, and I pointed this out to Mary Jo Foley, if you go to ZDNet, they did a redesign too, where they're doing, see the slash? And when you go to read an article, it has the breadcrumbs via slashes. Go to The Verge. Notice the slash, the breadcrumbs. It's
all very 1999.
It's a little weird, but I think that they kind of cribbed.
I like the ZDNet version.
Well, yeah, I like the ZDNet is a little bit anyway. And then what's this thing? Today's story stream, like they're doing a little Twitter.
Oh, thing. Some design company, man.
Twitter widget.
A lot of energy on a lot of nothing, if you ask me. But anyway, that's not what we're here for. It is only a rumor that the Pixel book is dead. So don't mourn too hard yet, right?
It's my candle of hope.
Google, according to Alex Heath and David Pierce, who I must say are very well connected at The Verge, has canceled the next version of the Pixelbook laptop and, to add insult to injury, dissolved the team responsible for building it.
That's the thing that tells me that there's no going back.
Right.
The device was far along in development and expected to debut next year, according to a person familiar with the matter, but cut as part of recent cost-cutting measures inside of Google. What was Google's revenue last quarter?
Yeah.
Not enough,
what
apparently.
What could this have cost?
So it is possible, because aren't they doing a tablet? Didn't they say we're doing a tablet?
Right.
Yeah, that's right. True.
And the whole foldable approach as well.
So maybe it's that they just feel like that's, and I presume a tablet would run, well, maybe no, it's an Android tablet, though.
Android, not Chrome OS.
It's not Chrome OS.
It's Chrome OS is what I love.
I was wondering, what if this was like a play Google did several years ago with the HTC partnership? They could go third party and say, hey, you handle all of this hardware, and then just, you know, we're going to give you some specs, but y'all handle it and take good a little bit of the stress off of us, and then we'll provide the software and you just dump it into place for us.
I guess one could be positive and say, well, but it's so mature, the market is so mature now that we don't need to show the way anymore.
Yeah.
But there was still, you know, when I was looking for the last machine, what did I end up getting? The last Google Chromebook.
Right.
The Pixelbook.
Pixelbook was always more expensive than anybody else's, but it was also higher end. It was worth it, usually. I still have a couple of them. I really like them. But they're also, by the way, out of date now, right?
They're old.
You don't get updates.
They are old.
People are willing to spend more on those other proprietary brands, though, right?
Yeah.
Oh, there's plenty.
My Pixelbook is also in black today and morning.
There are plenty of Chromebooks out there, Acer, Asus, Lenovo, so HP,
My friend Craig Newmark called me last week just thinking he needs to get a new one and asked me what I'd done. And I said, I love my Pixelbook Go. It's a really nice machine, but it's 2 years out of date now.
Yeah.
And I got a CX9 and hated it.
That was the
Acer. I remember that.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I remember you getting that, not being thrilled.
I thought, I was dying to get it. I couldn't get it. I was dying to be, I kept my hands on it. When I did, I just felt like it was the same as buying Google Glass. Felt like a schmuck.
All right. That's the bad news. Now all good news.
Blow out the candle.
Blow out the candle. Morning is over. Moving on. Wall Street Journal says they have learned that Twitter shareholders plan to approve the $44 billion takeover
already
by Elon Musk.
Passed you. They've
they already. It already passed?
It passed.
Okay.
It passed.
The vote was scheduled for Tuesday, 1 p.m. Eastern. And so the vote is in and it's passed. Not that that makes
overwhelmingly
any difference.
I voted against it. I took my shares and I voted against it.
Huh.
Not in my economic self-interest, but in the self-interest of democracy and freedom of speech and a free world.
Right. And because you want to stick it to Elon.
Yeah. I voted for four of the other things. There were three things on the ballot. One was paying the executives. I said, okay, fine, pay him. I forget what the other one was, but then I voted against the merger.
It's pretty clear after all of the revelations in this, and the court case will be October 17th in the Delaware Court of Chancery. It's pretty clear that Elon really only wanted to buy it for about 5 minutes and then immediately got cold feet because almost within a week, he asked his lawyer, can we put this off because World War III is about to happen?
Yeah, which is something.
I want to buy it.
He had to try to find the cash.
Well, I wonder, I guess it could be that that's what soured him on it, is realizing how much in hawk he was going to be. Anyway, it's pretty clear he's looking
that you used the phrase the other day, and I kept the last couple of shows ago, when there's an external event.
Adverse event.
World War III is the material adverse event. Yeah. It's just hilarious.
This is the one thing that does get him off the hook. Even though he stipulated he's going to buy Twitter as is, if there is a material adverse event, everybody quits or the company loses $1 trillion or, something that is really significant that wasn't foreseen, then he can say reasonably, oh, yeah, well, now I don't want it. And he's out. And I don't know, maybe he'd still have the $1 billion breakup fee. He'd be willing to take that at this point, I'm sure. But that's what he's looking for. He's also saying that paying Mudge, the former security director, Peter Zatko, $7.75 million in his termination contract is a material adverse effect. He's saying World War III is a material adverse effect. He's saying the bots are, whatever he can find. So we shall see. We'll continue to follow the story as we get closer to court time.
What is the court? Do you remember what
October 17th?
17th. So what day of the week is that?
You want to watch it live?
Doing and, a special.
we can do a special event. It's a Monday. But it's going to go on for a week, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
At least, yeah. This, at least, you know, they're going to talk to everybody and so forth and so on. Let's see. Evan Spiegel, the CEO of Snap, when asked at the Code conference about TikTok, said the secret to, first of all, he admitted TikTok is eating Snap's lunch. I think everybody knows that.
Along with everybody else's.
Yeah. Although if you follow Salt Hank on TikTok, it'll be a mighty tasty lunch. He's on Inside Hollywood again. I don't know if they'll let me play this or not. They tweeted it. Feels like they should allow me to. I don't know. I don't know what I can play anymore. I guess I'll just err on the side.
We haven't been taken down for TikTok videos. Well, I shouldn't say taken down. We haven't been slapped on the wrist about.
Well,
TikTok
this isn't
videos,
a TikTok so. Video. This is the Inside Hollywood. Mario Lopez with my son on the right, Hank's French dip versus Owen Hans.
Of course he did.
Yeah. Owen beat my son last time, so this is a rematch. Henry is going to make a French dip that is, oh my God.
Broil it.
Would you eat that, Aunt?
Please and thank you.
So I won't tell you who won. But watch Access Hollywood for the exciting, the thrilling, gripping.
That's so great that he's getting that kind
conclusion.
Of
so TikTok is eating Snap's delicious lunch, but he says the reason is, and this is kind of interesting, the Chinese government is pouring billions into TikTok. You know, they can't lose because they are so well funded. The strongest criticism of TikTok, this is from Forbes at Code, came from Matthias Döpfner, who, as you know, is the CEO of Axel Springer, which is a big, the big German publisher, right? And by the way, they're big in America. They own Insider, Politico, and Protocol. I didn't know that.
Yep.
Ooh.
Yep.
He says, TikTok should be banned in every democracy. I think it's silly. We can't enter China with Facebook, Google, Amazon, so why should we allow them in our free market economy?
So then my least favorite media personality, Scott Galloway, who will do anything to get attention, also said it should be banned.
I still find him hilarious. I'm sorry.
Oh, he's
Professor Galloway.
Drives people nuts.
He's a little bit of a, how should we say it? Yes, that's the word.
Attention
whore. Yeah.
He said, it feels like they're kicking the poop out of everybody at the Code conference. Anyway, billions and billions of dollars. That's what it takes to grow like TikTok.
But TikTok is, to me, right now, the most innovative platform, because it gave people, to use Matt's words, a new canvas and new paintbrushes.
You know, why isn't the likes of Snap or Instagram getting more support the way
what
TikTok
government
is?
Support?
You know, not government support, just financial support, because we have investors out there investing in all kinds of things that former WeWork guy put up. Aren't those people smart enough to look at something like a Instagram or
well, they were at early on in Snap. I don't remember what Snap's raise
Snap's
was.
Snap's awful right now.
Yeah, but as soon as Snap started tanking, I'm sure it became harder.
Where's the nearest door?
And harder.
But what I'm saying, why not throw money at it to help bring them back up and dethrone the likes of TikTok? You know, is this just a lost hope?
Well,
it's like,
okay,
you know, this is TikTok's game.
If their strategy is just to copy other innovation elsewhere, which is what Facebook has been doing, what Snap's been doing, then I would say they're not a good investment.
All right. To answer your question, when Snap was beginning and big, by the way, it was 7 years ago,
the TikTok of the world, right?
It was taken
over.
Absolutely. Their Series D round of funding, $485 million. Their Series E, $200 million, but up to $500 million. Their Series F, $1.8 billion. So Snap got started with billions and billions of dollars. Mm. Exactly the same. So it's a little funny of them to say, well, it's no fair. Snap, when they were hot, was raising money like crazy.
Yeah.
The problem is that they're faltering because of competition. It's not wrong. He says TikTok got this really great lead early on by aggressively expanding, spending a huge amount of money to do that, like somebody
same
else.
Same as you did.
So that people can train the algorithm and ultimately end up with a much more personalized feed that's harder to get a new service. That is true. There's a barrier to entry, just as there is with Google, just as there was with any Microsoft, any massively successful company. So TikTok has this algorithm that's going to be hard to compete with unless you have the network effect. Snap says, well, we'll compete with TikTok by focusing on connections with family and friends rather than strangers. But I think we've talked about this. There was a flip in what social media did. At first, it was family and friends. Now it's creators. And I think that Evan's wrong when he thinks that somehow they're going to come back by doing family and friends. I think that's why they failed, frankly, is they didn't have creators. They tried, and they couldn't get creators to put stuff on Snap. That's, I think, why.
Well, I also think we'll go overboard on creators, too.
Maybe then they'll be the next
thing. Like influencers.
As usual. Yeah.
What do you mean by that, Mr. Jarvis?
I just mean that now everything is creators. Every dollar goes into creators. Everything's creators. Everything's content. And we're losing the connections, I think, that people did value. Between them. So I think what we always do is we always go overboard. In media, we do that. In the technology, we do that. And everything, you know, everybody pivots the same direction and then marches together, only to discover that there's too many people there. In
the
early days of print,
Mr. Jarvis, they have reach. Is it not logical to go towards someone that has a bigger reach to help push your product?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying there.
The creators have a big reach. They have more of a reach than dadgum CBS in some instances.
We've always said that. That's why we are big on host red ads here at the Twit Network. I completely agree with you. I think, you know, when you see in an older era Ed McMahon feeding Alpo to a dog on the Johnny Carson show, or, you know, Paul Harvey flogging Bose Wave radios, that's very, very effective. That's not a new phenomenon. That's been since Arthur Godfrey. You know, that's always been that way. Milton Berle was sponsored. Who sponsored the Milton Berle show? Buick? Remember that?
Grandpa, I don't know.
Really? Come on, Jeff. Grandpa? You remember?
Jeez.
You remember the Milton Berle show?
It's overrated. That's what I remember.
But the point being that creators have always driven ad sales. But I don't think that necessarily means that social media will always be driven by creators. I think that's Jeff's point. Yeah, advertisers may like it, but I don't know. What would replace creators, Jeff? I mean,
I think collaboration is one. I think that's where
collabs
TikTok is interesting.
Yeah,
I think
we like stories. I think that's what Facebook found out. That's what everybody found out is. Yeah, it's nice to see what Aunt Maud's up to, but really, tell me a story.
Well, there the key is, if you get authentic stories, I think the one...
Texaco,
you know,
then Buick. Thank you, Swamp Rat, Milton Berle. Texaco Star Theater.
Now don't ask him who Milton Berle was. Please, don't ask him anybody.
Uncle Milty.
I've lost it.
Ah, good. I did it. I knew I could.
Well done, sir.
We were talking about creators.
Gutenberg. I was going to do Gutenberg.
No, don't mention Gutenberg. We were talking about story and how people like story. And so you know, Facebook thought at it would really be about your friends and family, connection. Remember Mark always said, life's better when you connect. And he's still saying it, by the way, with this new metaverse thing. No, We want stories. Remember briefly, there was this thought that you would build your own movies or build your own books and choose your own adventure. And then everybody realized, nobody wants to do that. I just want to sit back. Tell me a story, Daddy. That's all it's been ever since Homer was telling people about the Trojan War around the campfire. I trumped your Gutenberg and brought in Homer. I just want to point out.
Because you're even older than I am.
I'm even older.
But I also told our journalism students yesterday, beware the power of the story. When we in journalism take over somebody else's story, we think it's our story now. We exploit it. We extract it. There's a power relationship there that I have to be careful of. And I think that when companies also create a place where we're going to use your stories and make money on it, is going to come off being false, because then people start making up stuff to have a hotter story or a hotter take or a hotter whatever. And I think it's authenticity is what's going to matter. And I think that's going to come in different forms and different ways, that people feel they have their own space in their own way and that we believe them as themselves.
I think they're orthogonal.
Okay. Fancy word. Good. You got to use that fancy word.
Don't ask me what it means.
Hold on. Let me look that one up.
That we like story because it's how we make sense of the world. Really, the world is a horrific, chaotic place with no sense, rhyme, or reason. But we survive by making a story out of it. And that's how we understand things, is we tell a story about it. The authenticity, story or not, the authenticity is, yes, we love that. But I think that's not the same thing as why we tell stories. Yeah, I guess it'd be better if the storytelling was done by somebody who's got authentic, you know.
Well, stories can be authentic, and stories can also be propaganda.
Yeah, but I think you can lie in stories. I mean, I think a lot of the stories we tell.
That's what fiction is.
Yeah, in fact, the most compelling stories are lies, probably, you know. Just look at QAnon.
I wrote a post about 2 years ago and used this in the Gutenberg book. There's a book called How History Gets Things Wrong, The Science of Our Addiction to Stories. And it's an academic book, but it argues that, I mean, the author says, I like stories as much as the next person, but we make this presumption about how they turn out. And I think in the media age, we presume that everything had a beginning and an end and everything was neatly contained.
Right.
Gutenberg argument here, right? And so the story is myth. What's truer to real life is, I think, what we now think of as a stream.
Yeah, but I would submit we don't want that.
Going on and on.
Absolutely, that's more accurate. But we don't. I would submit we don't want that. We want fairy tales. We want myth.
Streams are working pretty well.
If you had a choice, on a YouTube video with a beginning, middle, and end, or one that was just slice of life. Sometimes we'll watch a movie or TV show. Manchester by the Sea was an example, which I thought was a beautiful movie, but doesn't end. It's right. It's what we call a slice of life fiction, right? It's just a piece of life without a beginning, right, middle, and end. Lisa said, "That's it?" I said, "Well, yeah, it's just a slice of life. It's just, there's no end." She said, "Well, what happened?" I said, "No, no, it's just a slice." She says, "No, but what happened?" Right? We want a beginning, middle, and end. We prefer it.
But then again, a blog has the beginning.
I think it depends on who the person is or the subject of that slice of life. Yeah. Neistat, all he did was slice of life stuff and just totally blew up with it even more than his TV show did.
That was pure authenticity, wasn't it? That was authenticity winning.
He's going down the streets of New York with a camera and people looking at him like he's a damn fool.
I don't think it's as long lived though as a good story. I think Shakespeare is going to last longer than Casey Neistat.
Yeah, stories are passed down.
Yeah.
Wait. Let's put this in granite. I think Shakespeare is going to last longer than Casey Neistat.
Yeah.
Neil LaPorte futurist.
Yeah. Because authenticity only gets you so far. Do you care if Shakespeare was an authentic guy? Do you care? Oh, that Shakespeare, he was a hell of a guy. No. The stories survive.
I care that Cervantes had an amazing life and used that life in his fiction.
Most people read Don Quixote have no idea what Cervantes' life was like.
Well, only because, but you realize that it's good. And the reason it's good is because he used his,
he had a good life. Well, okay, whatever it is, that, tough life, whatever fuel you use to feed your storytelling, that's nice. That's why I say it's authenticity is orthogonal, because it's nice, yeah, but it's not the same. It's not in the same axis as storytelling. Storytelling lives on and is as a long term compelling value. And Casey Neistat, that's great. It's very authentic. You like him, but you know, no YouTube celebrity has. I mean, where's PewDiePie now? Right? They don't last. We move on, don't we?
Again, it depends on the person.
Yeah,
PewDiePie is sort of forgotten, but Neistat is still doing his thing and still at all of the film festivals because of his name recognition.
He's not on YouTube, though, right? He doesn't do YouTube anymore.
He's still on YouTube. I just watched his latest
video. Oh, did you? Okay. I thought he kind of slowed down on YouTube.
Why did you watch?
Yeah, why are you watching that stuff?
He's an interesting creator, and I love the fact that he's someone that just...
Oh, Neistat. I thought you meant PewDiePie.
No.
Who did you just watch?
No.
See, oh, okay.
I saw this.
I like Casey too.
I saw this video, which is him saying, I miss being a YouTuber, and I took that to mean he doesn't do YouTube that much anymore, but I guess he does. So
yeah, he's still going.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, he got a million views on his list.
What happened to his whole big company and big studio and big all everything? Is that still around?
No, Beam, that was the last company I remember. That was the little social network app. And then there was another, like a Creator Academy thing that he was working on in New York. But
trust me,
really
I'm not
much about it.
I'm not down. Look, I'm not telling a story. I live on personality, right? I mean, and I'm nowhere near as successful as Neistat. But I mean, I'm on that axis, absolutely, mm-hmm. on the personality axis. But I think ultimately the stuff that really lives and lasts is storytelling. And that's why, you have to have a creator to tell a story. But I think the most successful storytellers, creators will be storytellers, I guess is what I'm right. saying.
I also think part of what I do in the book, and I can't even give you a pre-order page yet to plug. So wait till I get that, man. I'm really going to be bad. But I talk about conversation over content. I think that media were in their early days truly conversational. And that ended when it became mass and scale. And I think what the internet allows us to do is recapture that. And we're doing a rotten job of it. We're out of practice for 500 years. We don't know how to do it as a society. But I think there's value in what we're doing right now. We're not really telling stories right now.
No, we're having conversations.
We're conversing. Yeah, and I think that has value.
Oh, yeah.
It's orthogonal to nothing.
I'm not saying it doesn't have value. In fact, the problem with storytelling is you become passive consumers. You just sit
yes,
back
exactly.
and listen to the
audience.
Story. And I think we do crave, as human beings, we crave that kind of communication.
Yes.
So we definitely need that. But I think it's a different scale. Again, it's orthogonal. It's like, it doesn't mean storytelling is not important or that creators and authenticity is important. They're separate. They're right angles to one another. You know, right. they're not, it's not either or. And I actually wonder where we go with conversation. Because, I mean, look at Facebook. Look at most social media sites. They've become content sites, not communications sites. But we still have Discord, mm-hmm. right? I really love our Discord. Yep. I love the conversations we have in there. So I don't know. I mean, I think we need that as humans.
We need both. Whether it's both. I mean, the Homer, to go back to you, would come in town and
right.
and recite the story. Yes, but then people would talk about it. It would give them right. something to talk about.
I got it. Stories mass consumption. Communication is at a small scale. It's human. It's personal scale, right?
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. yeah, I think the mistake, I think Siva Vaidyanathan would argue that the mistake was thinking that connecting the whole world would work.
It's not what we wanted.
Well, that's not a question whether we wanted it or not. We didn't have the norms and the structures and the guardrails to understand how to do it well. There was no definition of well.
Right.
But having said that, I love my conversations with you guys. I love the conversations I have on Twitter. I love a lot of conversations I still have on Facebook. But you're right, Leo. You're either broadcasting,
right,
or not. I we talked when you were gone last week. By the way, I'm eager to hear how the concert was, and glad you still have your hearing. we talked about a consent decree that expired last month that prevented studios from owning movie theaters. That's gone now. That's why we have so much streaming going on. And this was explained in a thread we talked about last week. As I thought about that more and more, the fact that NBC is rumored to be giving up its 10 o'clock hour, what I think we come to is an end of broadcast writ large. And what we have now on social media is everybody's trying to be a broadcaster, right? Everybody's trying to broadcast everything they have to say to a lot of people. And yep. And because all we valued was scale, all we valued was huge. But if you go back before the steam-powered press, sorry, guys, the average circulation of a daily newspaper in America before the steam-powered press, you want to guess how much?
52,000.
4,000.
4,000? Ooh.
It was a Substack newsletter.
Yeah.
The average newspaper.
Right? I think that's right. I think that's right.
And scale changed everything.
Yeah. In fact, that's kind of what we were talking about earlier with Matt. It's okay for Tumblr to be a tenth the size of Twitter, which is a tenth the size of Facebook.
Yeah, which is great.
It's okay. In fact, we need a lot of small spaces. That's a better way to socialize. That's what we really want. I think that's one of the reasons Discord is so cool. The Twit Discord is a small group. I mean, it's 3,000, give or take, but a relatively small group of people who know each other, have a common interest, and we hang out together. It's human scale. And it doesn't scale well. I couldn't make this a 300 million person Discord. No one would want to be in it. Twitter, in some ways, was at its best when it was in the early days, right? Or was it?
Depends on who you ask. If you're asking a person that's wanting to have community, they would say, yes, it was way better back in the days.
Well, you make your own community by how you create who you follow and stuff. So you can make a sub community within the Twitter.
Right.
That's, I guess.
And now they have this whole, circles and.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's really the best thing about Twitter.
They're trying to really get back to that aspect of it now. But again, if you ask a broadcaster, they're going to tell you, oh, Twitter's great now. It stunk in the beginning because nobody was there.
Right. In fact, that was what I'm thinking about Tumblr is, oh, yeah, fine. I guess I'll post stuff there, but nobody will see it. Mm-hmm. Right. There is a certain critical mass. I look at our Mastodon instance, Twit Social, which I really like, but it's just not big enough. There are not enough people in it for conversations to really get started. We're just right
on
the edge of that.
It's trying to mimic Twitter, and it can't be Twitter, so it needs to be something else.
Yeah,
I think that's the same thing. When I was writing last week about the TV stuff, I looked back at VidCon and a picture I had from 2000. I don't know what was it, 17, 18, and the ads from YouTube were all trying to create series because YouTube wanted to be TV. No, right. YouTube should be YouTube.
Right.
Marshall McLuhan says that every medium. Is the content of every medium is the medium that came before. And so they first try to be what was before,
right,
before they invent what they are.
Right. And ultimately, you have to find your voice. You have to find, every medium has to find its unique style of voice. And that's why, you don't post the same thing on Facebook, or you shouldn't post the same thing on Facebook. You post on Instagram, you post on Twitter.
Right.
Different audiences.
It's different. Each one has to find
Snap
its own
did
voice.
So well.
Yeah.
With media companies was they said you cannot repurpose. You cannot just take your stuff. You've got to be doing what's native to Snap, which was smart while it lasted.
Yeah. Okay, well, we solved that problem. Let's move. I don't know
you
what
know,
we
this
accomplished.
Also made me think about, though, the whole discussion we had several weeks ago about Instagram and photographers.
Yeah.
And everything, just sort of being more video-centric.
Right.
You've seen the rebirth, if you will, of Vero. Have you gone into Vero?
V-E-R-O?
Yes, sir.
This is it says a social media platform and mobile app for photographers?
Yes, sir.
Ah,
You know, so we've seen
I was looking at Visco, VSCO, which was the old school Vero. Oh yeah, I did Vero for a week. Right. I remember Vero. Yeah, I did it for a week. Yeah.
But did you download Vero 2.0?
Oh no, what's new with 2.0?
I don't know.
Voice and video calls. Okay, I rest my case.
Yeah. Everybody does what everybody does.
Oh yeah, well,
everyone was saying that, all right, I'm done with Instagram because it's not promoting my images, yada yada yada. And actually they were saying I'm not getting any engagement. There's no community inside of Instagram anymore. What they were really saying is it's not promoting my images. So they're going over to the likes of Vero. And I'm wondering if people are going to just sort of bail out on it again, because this isn't Vero's first run.
Yeah, look at this. This is a pivot.
For years.
This is Vero trying to save itself by trying everything. So,
Leo, there is no orthogonality.
You collect bookmarks.
Everybody's doing what everybody else is doing.
You do voice and video calls.
They're all trying to go in the same direction.
You do music.
You post links to articles in there.
You do. Yeah, you do, beyond features, a culture to support creators. You post your photos. Okay, I could tell you right now, that's a failure. Instantly. Because what is it? Is it a music playing app? Is it a bookmark app? Is it a photo app? Is it a video?
Whatever you want it to be, Leo, will be everything you want it to be. Just love us.
That's a failure. Don't you think that that's not going to go anywhere? Because this is total desperation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Total desperation. Pick something.
I'm curious to see what's going to happen with it. I still have my account in there and I'll post to it here and there, but I don't use these platforms for the same reason that other photographers use it.
Did you ever use Visco?
I would use the editing tool in it.
Well, this is why I like Visco. So it is a very clean photo site with very nice built-in editing tools. And I started posting there thinking this might be my Instagram replacement, but there's no one there.
There's no one there.
So there's also that. You know, if people don't,
you know, if you're wanting community, you're still going to want some people there. But if you're someone that's broadcasting, like I tend to do, I definitely need someone there because I'm.
If you're posting photos, well, I guess there's two reasons you could post photos. One is Facebook style. You want to show your family and friends. The other is Aunt Pruitt style, which is you want an audience. You want to show people what you're doing.
Yep.
Yeah.
You want a home for it.
Yeah. Whatever happened to 500 pixels? Is that still around?
Still there, but I believe most of that crowd is turned towards Flickr because the community aspect of 500px tend to get a little bit tarnished with all of these snobbery back in the days.
And now they have an NFT vault, so you know they're on their way. Yeah, it's sad. I think Flickr's kind of history, don't you?
Well, Flickr is one of those that got ruined.
But then they got bought by the wonderful folks at SmugMug. Log into my Flickr.
Yeah, I still use Flickr.
We use it for the tech guy. We use it for our photo assignments. Chris Marquardt. You know, we put photos up there. We have actually a pretty big tech guy group. I think there's like 13,000 people in it. 13,926 members. So yeah, we're using it. But I don't feel like this is on the upswing.
But I don't go
either.
There for community aspect, actually. I'm using it more so for an easy way to share photos an easy way to back up stuff. But if I want engagement and interaction, I'm going to Twitter and Instagram because that's where my audiences are.
I recently had a photo on the Explore page on Flickr, which at one time was the thing, right? You get a photo on the Explore page, and you're going to get hundreds of thousands of views.
Gosh, I love that
likes.
Shot, man.
I know.
Gosh, I love
shot?
That one.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was very honored. I got that on the Explore page. Didn't really, nothing much happened. 123 faves. So, yeah, I think Flickr, I mean, that's an indicator. Flickr's not exactly taken off either. I don't know. You know,
I saw a thread a while back about this whole photographers being pissed off. And the thread basically said, look, yeah, you want more engagement, but the problem is those other platforms that you're going to because you're thinking you can get more engagement, they're not promoting to people outside of the world of photography. You know, so when you go to Vero, you're pretty much looking at just other photographers, and those other photographers are not as engaging as the person that's just in there to look at pretty pictures,
right?
In general.
So it's all gotten much more fragmented, but I kind of agree with Matt. That's okay. Let a thousand flowers bloom.
Oh, absolutely.
And we'll have our own individual, you just have to find your community.
Go where your crowd is. Go where your audience is.
Yeah. Hey, an amazing story just in the New York Times. People are going crazy over it. Do you know the Patagonia label?
Yeah, this just went up, yeah.
Yeah. Patagonia is probably one of the best-selling outdoors clothing company. They sell, you've seen it's all the startup guys wear Patagonia puffy jackets and Patagonia fleeces, right? If you go to Allen & Co., it's all Patagonia all the time. Very successful company. The founder, who's now 83, he was, just some guy who really liked mountain climbing, who started it in 1973, Yvon Chouinard, has announced they're going to give the entire company away, effective immediately. 100% of Patagonia's earnings will not be reinvested, but will be distributed to the Holdfast Collective, which will use them to help fight the environmental crisis. 100% of profits from now on, which is roughly $100 million a year.
Paul Newman got mad.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, it is.
If you're an outdoorsman, here he is in his youth just before he started Patagonia, ready to climb some rock, clearly. and you want to sell outdoor goods, maybe donate. For a long time, they donated a portion of the proceeds, now donating 100% to ending the climate catastrophe. They're down in Ventura, California. Nice story. This is from Outside Magazine. Let's take a little break. I kind of miss Stacy. Nobody has
slapped. Well,
of course we do. Nobody slapped me around.
You miss getting slapped around.
Nobody.
Oh, okay. Well, if you want to be slapped around, Matt and I can do this. No problem.
All right. I appreciate it.
Call Madam Matt and Madam Jeff, and we're
Our show today brought to you by Cashfly. Really, quite literally, brought to you by Cashfly. Cashfly is amazing, and I know because I've been using them practically since Twitch started. That's when you download a podcast in your podcast client or you go to our website and download it, you're downloading it from our CDN, our content delivery network. That's Cashfly. When we first started, we had a web page. You download from the web page. That failed immediately. We tried a whole bunch of different ways to distribute content, including BitTorrent. That's when Matt Levine, the founder of Cashfly, came to me and said, Leo, we can fix this. And they have ever since. In fact, when we started a video, I was really worried, guys, we're going to go, basically an order of 10 more size downloads. And they said, no problem. We do more than, I think we do 2 petabytes a month through Cashfly. It's amazing. Now Cashfly has expanded into streaming video, ultra low latency video streaming. You can go live in hours, not days, with sub-1-second latency. Ditch that unreliable WebRTC solution for their WebSocket live video workflow. And here's the best part. It'll scale to more than 1 million users without a hiccup. One of the reasons Cashfly is so great is they have 50 points of presence, 50 servers all around the globe. So your content will be closer to your customers, which outperforms local CDNs and really makes a big difference. When you're listening to our show in, for instance, the Middle East, you're getting it from a server in the Middle East or South America or Europe or Canada and so forth and so on. You can also reduce your bandwidth, take a load off your Origin servers, reduce your S3 bills with Cashfly's storage optimization system, make your cache hit ratio 100% because your stuff lives on Cashfly. They also have fully managed CDN solutions because you don't have time to run your CDN. With Cashfly's elite managed packages, you'll get VIP treatment and 24/7 support with response times less than an hour. So what do you get with Cashfly? What do we get with Cashfly? Ultra low latency video streaming that delivers video to more than a million concurrent users. Lightning-fast gaming delivers downloads faster with zero lag, glitches, or outages. Mobile content optimization that offers automatic and simple image optimization so your site loads faster on any device. Multiple CDNs for redundancy and failover, intelligently balancing your traffic across multiple providers, which gives you the shortest routes and mitigates against performance glitches. It works so well, they've had 100% availability in the past 12 months, 10 times faster than traditional methods on six continents, 30% faster than other major CDNs with a 98% cache hit ratio. That's CacheFly. 24/7, 365 priority support, too, so you'll always have them there for you when you need them. Learn more at CacheFly.com. You've heard me say it at the beginning of almost every show. Bandwidth for This Week in Google is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. Thank you, CacheFly. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you to Mr. Jason Howell, who took over kind of last minute last week when I ran the hell out of here to go see Joan Jett, Poison, Motley Crue, and Def Leppard. All bands.
You ain't young anymore, but you can try to be.
I had no idea. I didn't know anything about these bands, but Lisa loves them. And she danced nonstop for 6 hours, got 27,000 steps.
Wow.
At that show. Mostly just boing, boing, boing. It was really fun. It was really fun. So thank you. And I hope it went well without me.
How long did it go?
6 hours.
Jeez.
Four bands. Whew, started at about 4:30 in the afternoon and ended about 11.
Yeah. Wow. That was a pooped puppy, Leo.
Oh, I just sat there and nodded off. I just went, yeah, let me know when Leopard's on. No, I had fun. I had fun. What else do you want to? What else should we talk about today? I thought this was kind of interesting. When Queen Elizabeth passed, traditionally, you know, London Bridge is down. The code word. The plans call for the BBC channels 1, 2, and 4 to interrupt all programming, briefly shift to a display of the network's famous logo, and then broadcasting a unified message saying the Queen has passed quietly and so forth, so on. And then, we actually saw it on TV. They put a, poster up on the palace gates and all that. Not this year. The death of the Queen preceded the BBC announcement by several minutes thanks to the Twitter account of the royal family. They were so anxious, they tweeted it, and then the BBC got to do its thing. I don't know if it's a breach of protocol, but it just
the BBC
shows...
BBC had already gone to a black banner on top.
No, according to Quartz, the news of the death broke first on social media with a post from the Twitter account, and then 2 minutes...
No, I know that, but part of this thing is the BBC has a red logo banner on top.
Oh.
And before the death was announced, they switched to black because the doctors were very concerned.
Oh, okay.
So everybody knew it was imminent.
Okay.
Okay? I mean, why is it a problem that...
No. It's a sign of the times.
It's just a sign of the times.
It's not a problem. Okay. It's a sign of the times. You tweet it before you beep it.
Right. Show title.
They are orthogonal. Orthogonal.
They might be orthogonal. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, this obviously was with the cooperation of the BBC and the royal family and everybody. This is probably was in the write-up in London Bridge. We haven't seen the secret plans, but I just think it's fascinating that they decided, the first announcement shouldn't be a placard on the gates of the palace, shouldn't be on the... That was the way they did it for hundreds of years, right? Then along comes television. Oh, we're going to do it on radio probably first. Oh, we'll do it on radio first. Announce it to the country. Now it's on Twitter.
To Her Royal Highness? I'm not sure the proper way to address the Queen.
It's okay. You're American. You don't need to worry about it.
But wasn't that a credit to her? She was a bit more on the technological advancements and things over time.
No, she didn't even have a smartphone.
No, but I mean, far as
they trotted her out.
No, I mean, far as being someone that leaned into the available tech, I want to say Mr. Ian Thompson wrote something up.
Oh, did he?
Telling some things.
Oh, did he? Oh, interesting. I think it's, you know, it's a, they call it the firm, you know, the family business. Mm-hmm. And I think the family business is more savvy. Absolutely.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, they're younger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, well, and also just kind of more cognizant of what's going on. You know, I'll have to ask Ian. You know, it's funny because there are a lot of people who are not royalists, who are not, you know, saying, why are we making such a big deal about this? But Ian is very much, as long as I've known him, he's always kind of a real soft spot for Queen Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I'll look at the article. I didn't see it. I missed it.
All right, Leo, I'm curious. How did the story next in the rundown end up in there? What's the connection?
I don't know. I just put it there. Okay. You know what? Here's the connection. We talk a lot about supply chain, right?
Okay.
And I didn't know this. But this has a lot to do with supply chain. Before COVID, if you wanted to buy an entire container, let's say you have 100,000 Kewpie dolls you want to ship from Shanghai to San Francisco, right before COVID, that would have cost you about $1,500. $1,500.
Not bad.
You get those Kewpie dolls in. I mean, you know, that's one of the reasons Chinese goods are cheap, right? But as soon as COVID hit, that price skyrocketed to $20,000 by August 2021. So this is really a direct contributor to supply chain. You know, we talk a lot about, oh, there are not enough trucks. There's, you know, you can't get enough container ships in the ports, et cetera, et cetera. It's simply cost. No, that's not inflation. Going from $1,500 to $20,000 in a year.
Has an impact on.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. It's back down, by the way. It's right now, it's about $6,000, but still
nothing.
What's
going to happen any day now?
What's that?
Rail strike.
Yes. Oh. Yes. That'll be interesting. I am old enough to remember, you probably are too, Jeff.
Yeah.
When, who was it, said there shall be no, was it Johnson?
Was it Eisenhower?
Or maybe Eisenhower.
I don't know.
Who said the feds in, said, no, railroad strike. The nation runs on the railroads. Biden kind of hinted at that when he said, no, it's too important to allow a strike.
Especially before the midterms.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll
but would we notice, honestly?
That's what I was thinking too. Well, the supply chain would.
Yeah.
The trucks now carry so much.
Right.
In the U.S.
It could derail critical deliveries of chlorine to wastewater plants. See, it's weird, the things that are delivered by train.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Maybe because it's a dangerous chemical. You can't do that in trucks. I don't know. Okay. Interesting. Anyway, I thought that, no, that's why I put that in there, because I thought, well, that's really interesting. It got to the point right towards the end of the COVID where Walmart was chartering their own vessels just to get enough goods into their stores.
Yeah. Well, speaking of inflation.
But then, oh, wait a minute, there's a sequel to this, because then as a result, they had too many goods in the stores. So, I mean, it's just difficult to handle, I guess, these. The party is over, says Jonathan Roach, a container shipping analyst at London-based Brimar.
Meanwhile, Amazon, which I think has had a huge impact on wages in America, thus inflation, but for good cause, to get people's wages up higher because they paid everybody $15 an hour, they're now going to spend more on wages so they can hold on to staff and deliver through the holidays.
Yeah,
and so that's
fine and dandy,
impact.
But you still can't be ridiculous with your employment practices, and you know, they gotten out of trouble with all of the bathroom policies and stuff like that?
I think they're making changes there too. Yeah. I forget what I saw. I saw something about that.
Starbucks has an interesting angle on anti-unionization. They offer benefits to employees who have not joined the union, like a new student loan repayment tool and a savings account program. Don't join the union, we'll take care of you. Join the union.
Some say is illegal.
Yeah.
Which state is it that legal in?
they're doing it. It must be legal everywhere. I don't know. Wow. I mean, you could just say, no. We figure the union guys, they got their own representation. So we're going to take care of the people who want in the unions.
I can't say too much terrible about Starbucks. I don't go there to get coffee or anything, but Hardhead works for them and they take care of him.
Oh, because they don't want him to vote for a union. You bet.
He's been totally fine between going to college and transferring up there without a hitch.
I'm not against that. I think the threat of a union, if it makes an employer behave better, that's fine too, right?
Yeah, good.
Right?
Good.
Yeah. Our son is in the grocery workers union. Local 8, Golden State, baby.
Interesting.
Yeah. He was a little surprised because they ding him $60 a month.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, that's the price you pay.
I'm in the professional services Congress, whatever it's called.
As a professor, are you in a union?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm a SAG-AFTRA man myself.
Of course. That's right.
And I do pay. I pay at least that much in dues. A couple hundred. What is it? I don't remember, but it's like maybe $700 a year. And boy, do I get a lot from that. Google. Oh, we got a Google story. Not a good one for the Goog. But for that, we have to go back to urge. Why did you take parts of the letters out? Paul Theroux said they took exactly enough out so that you can still read it. But no more, right? No excess. Very weird. Google has lost its appeal over illegal Android bundling. The fine, which was originally 4.3 billion euros, was slightly reduced, but the EU General Court did largely confirm the ruling. The company imposed unlawful restrictions on Android phone manufacturers in order to promote its search engine on mobile devices. This is big, 4.1 billion euros. That's a lot of money. That's no slap on the wrist.
Yep.
The ruling by the General Court today upheld the vast majority of the commission's original charges. The court did find, this is from the Urge, that the Google's revenue sharing schemes with manufacturers did not constitute an abuse of Google's market power. So adjusted the fine by 5% to 4.1 billion euros. That I think it's the largest fine ever. Google has to wait 2 months and 10 days before it can appeal once more. So it can appeal to the highest court. There's one more appeal left, the Court of Justice. In the statement, Google said,
"Well, we're disappointed that the court did not annul the decision in full. Android has created more choice for everyone, not less."
Which is true, yeah. Actually.
"And supports thousands of successful businesses in Europe and around the world."
I kind of think Google's getting the bad.
I think this is like EU and Microsoft all over again.
Yeah.
And the difference is Android is open source.
Yeah, so the deal was if you want to sell the Google version of Android, not AOSP, you had to agree not to sell phones. If you want your phones for your, you want official Google for your high-end phones, you have to agree not to sell your low-end phones with the open source AOSP.
Which makes some sense from a branding perspective for Google is, am I getting a good Android phone or a bad Android phone from this company?
But you also have to install Google Search and Chrome alongside the Google
Which also makes sense for consumers because I got a Google phone. Where's Google?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
they just want to go after them, and they have.
Yeah, I don't know where I stand on this. I mean, it isn't like there's a whole bunch of other choices, right?
Mr. Jarvis,
Yes, sir.
You walk up to someone on the street or what have you, just, you know, the average person, and ask them about their Android phone. Are they going to call it a Google phone, or are they just going to call it, it's a Samsung?
Right.
Do they even get that?
Never hear them say a Google phone. I hear them say a Samsung phone or an Android phone. I hear people say Android, but yeah. I don't hear Google.
Yeah, I never hear Google thrown into conversation. It's always a Droid. I even hear that. It's a Droid.
Yes.
Or
yes.
I hear them mention something about Samsung, as in as if they were in control of it. So that's when I was like, I don't even know if that matters.
They're going bonkers for Mr. Beast in New Jersey. Everybody wants a Beast Burger. Mr. Beast, who is a YouTube phenom, by I think chiefly by giving away millions of dollars, right? Here he is at the mall where the Mr. Beast Burger
joint. It's the
first
actual store, because Mr. Beast is a, what do you call those?
Pop-up.
Ghost kitchen.
Yeah, ghost kitchen. Yeah, yeah, they're not... So it, people waited in line for as much as 10 hours to get a Mr. Beast smash burger.
Oh, boy.
Boy, that is YouTube celebrity.
Good grief. Yeah.
That's, that is mind-boggling. Not nearly as good, I think, as a nice au jus French dip sandwich made by Salt Hank. I'm just saying.
Salt Hank, come on. Make that happen, Salt Hank. Make, come on.
Set up that
Wednesday
store. YouTube's teaming up with Shake Shack for some new... menu items. This is from the YouTube series The Hot Ones. Those are the, isn't that the guys where they sit around and interview people and make them eat hot sauce?
Yep, yep.
They get some of the biggest names. I can't believe, you know, if I had known that the secret to getting great interviews was to torture your subject, I would have installed an electric chair in here a long time ago.
We want electric chair.
Yeah, just zap them a little bit. No, that's not the answer I was looking for. Make them jump. Put Elon in there. They get the biggest celebrities to eat their hot, hot, hot wings. Anyway.
That show is still pretty good, sir.
Yeah, because people are laughing at these celebrities because they're in pain.
That's what TV was invented for, was to laugh at people and not be seen doing it.
And some of those folks, they let go. You know, some of the celebrities.
Because they're eating really hot food. Is that it?
No.
Here's Margot Robbie stripping down so she can eat some hot sauce. That's not bad for ratings.
Yeah, we used to watch that pretty regularly here in the house.
So, yeah, I know. I just wish I'd thought of this sooner.
Well, you could still implement it.
If you had told me, oh, yeah, just you could interview celebrities as long as you hurt them, they love it. I don't get it.
Where did Justine.
Where did I go wrong?
Is that I, Justine?
No, no, it's Margot Robbie. It's a world-famous movie star, Margot Robbie. It was definitely in pain.
Looks like her.
I'm going to put in little small, like not a lethal electric chair, just a little make you jump electric chair.
just a little
yeah.
Zap.
Yeah.
Well, it's what Stacy wants to do to you.
Yeah, maybe I should just do that. Yeah, I should just do that. Anyway,
zap yourself.
Now I'm just jealous because now Shake Shack. Has
brand
hot ones for menu items, so you can hurt yourself. Shake Shack hot ones. Can you handle the heat? I swear to God, if you just told me that I had to hurt people, I would have, you know, I would have done something about it. I could have done that.
Imagine what you could have done with Dvorak. Torture.
People would have loved that.
Yeah, exactly.
Love that. You know, it's just impossible these days to get into Fashion Week parties because of TikTokers. They're just crowding the whole place. I hate it.
It's a hilarious story where they're going on about, wow, why is this so crowded? It took me 2 hours to try to get in. Isn't there a mistake being made? I'm on the list. But the truth is, what's really happening, and I thought Stacy was here, so we're talking fashion, that's why I put these in here, was that Vogue is not the determiner of style anymore.
Yeah.
TikTok is.
Yeah.
The people are the determiners of style now, which I think is way cool, but boy, do the old people hate it, except Vogue then threw a whole event to try to be cooler than cool and make... downtown in the meat market, meatpacking district in New York, they're all trying to be TikTok cool now because they've lost their cool to TikTok.
Isn't that right. Amazing?
Got to embrace it.
It is.
Yeah, and I can't get too unhappy about it, to be honest.
No, I can't either.
Hey, speaking of menus, Chipotle, guess who added this story? Chipotle has added a new dish inspired by... TikTok?
Oh, that's the wrong
link. Yeah, you gave me the wrong link. This is shakshuka. I guarantee you Chipotle is not selling shakshuka.
Sorry about that.
Judge allows McFlurry machine repair lawsuit to proceed.
This is good. A Cory Doctorow cause.
Kitch, K-Y-T-C-H, was a company that reverse engineered the McFlurry machine so that they could be easier to maintain and break down less. The company that makes the McFlurry machine, Taylor, has been engaged in a long-running legal dispute about whether Taylor could prevent Kitch devices. It's not the whole machine. It's just a device you put on the machine to keep it from breaking. Could be used. You know, the conspiracy theory is Taylor makes a lot of money on these repairs, but if you've ever tried to get a McFlurry, you know that the machines are broken a lot. Before Kitch came along, Taylor had a repair monopoly on the McFlurry machine. If you didn't clean it just right, the machine had shut down, and only
Taylor,
a certified Taylor technician, could get it going again. So Kitch figured out how to create a device that allows McDonald's franchise owners to do basic repairs on the machine and get them running. Taylor didn't like that, saying, well, you could hurt yourself. Ironically, it was Kitch that claimed Taylor stole Kitch's trade secrets because Taylor began selling a device very similar.
Oh, that's interesting.
So the court granted a restraining order against Taylor. Then Kitch went further, filed a complaint, a First Amend complaint, whatever that is. Taylor filed a demur, and then the fisticuffs began. In a court document filed a couple of weeks ago, a judge allowed Kitch's restraining order to proceed. Kitch alleged 10 different claims against Taylor, including that it had falsely advertised his product and engaged in unfair competition. So the shoe's on the other foot now. Kitch has the upper hand. The judge agreed with Kitch on 7 counts.
Which is all good for the repair it movement.
Yeah.
The right to repair.
Yeah.
Right to repair.
Yeah.
A story I didn't put in the rundown, or I just did, which I didn't know. John Deere is also at the center of all this because they put out these tractors and the farmers can't repair them and can't do anything.
Same thing.
So 10% of their revenue by 2030 will come from software fees.
Oh.
And the margin on those software fees, by one estimate, is 85% versus 25% for equipment sales. So they're not going to be let loose of locking down your tractor or your softy machine.
I like your stories this week, Jeff. Here's from Ion Design at AIGA.org. We spoke with the last person standing in the floppy disk business. There is somebody still selling floppy disks. His name is Tom Persky. He's the founder of floppydisk.com, a U.S. company that sells and recycles floppy disks. They will also, by the way, transfer your data off of a floppy disk if you need that.
Because you have no means to do that.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
Here he is with his little floppy disk factory. Wild.
Well, he actually buys them. He buys them from any source because they've stopped selling, making them. So it's a diminishing resource that he has.
Yeah.
He
says 20 years ago, I was actually in the floppy disk duplication business. Not in a million years did I think I would ever sell blank floppy disks. Duplicating disks in the 1980s and early 1990s was as good as printing money. It was unbelievably profitable. Who knew? Again, hot sauce to celebrities or duplicating disks. My paths were many, but I failed in every case to follow them. He was a tax lawyer in Washington, D.C., left his practice with Price Waterhouse, moved to California, started doing floppy disk duplication. And there they are. There's the duplication machines. They're kind of
a little
ratty.
Worse for the wear.
They are getting a little ratty. So AIGA asks him, so where does this focus on floppy disks come from? Why not work with another medium? Well, anyway, it's a
this
fascinating.
It's just like the stories about the last typewriter repairman.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And there are probably places with brand new floppy disks. He says the most in demand is the standard 1.44 megabyte, 3.5-inch blank floppy. I would say the most valuable are currently the 720 kilobyte double density disks. Of course, wow. There are especially 8-inch disks for which there is a very small demand and of which we have only a small inventory. They're absolutely irreplaceable. The same could be said about quad density.
God, I threw out boxes of these things. I could have sold them to the guy.
I wonder if the same thing, like valuable. 78 records, went through the same kind of, you know, long tail. Long tail.
I just read a book from the 40s, or from the 60s, The View from the 40th Floor by Theodore White, who became famous for having written later The Making of the President in 1960.
Oh, yeah.
This is a Romana Clay about the folding of Collier's magazine. You would say Collier, but I'll say Collier.
I wouldn't say it. Mullen would say Collier.
Yes, exactly. So at the end, a spoiler, since you're never going to read it, the magazines fold. And the newsroom does black bunting in the newsroom using typewriter ribbons.
Oh. You can get those are inky, though. You get your ink on your hands.
Well, you know, they're leaving the place.
Let's see.
Can I mention one story here?
Yeah. I'm looking at your list. You have Klobuchar. A great list. Oh, Klobuchar. Amy.
Yeah. So her bill, which was a protectionist bill for the middle part of the newspaper industry to give them money, to force the platforms, rather, to give them money, to force them to carry their content, not allow them to leave news, which is a First Amendment nightmare. It was headed for, it was in hearings, and then Ted Cruz, and as usual, it's Republicans and conservatives ganging up on the internet companies. And then Ted Cruz put in an amendment that kind of made no sense, but basically was, if any of you were going to try to moderate our content and take our content off, then all the game's off. And Klobuchar said, well, that ruined the bill. So then the bill stopped, and then it's supposed to go to markup tomorrow, but probably will not. And so it's almost dead, but it's not dead. It's going to come back. And it's terrible, terrible legislation. And it aims to force the platforms to enter into negotiation. You will negotiate and make offers. They have to make at least two offers for content, which they say we don't want and we don't need and we shouldn't pay for. And they can't use their own value that they bring to this equation in terms of audience in those negotiations. And they must carry the content, which I think, again, is a violation of the First Amendment like crazy. And any business that has more than 1,500 employees is out. So it's not the New York Times. But the fear is what's going to happen is these hedge funds will just cut employees down in every newspaper to below 1,500. And there you go. And unless you have 100,000 revenue, you can't get in the deal. So small local weekly newspapers and sites can't get in it. And so it's this horrible, horrible piece of legislation that's just her trying to punish the platforms for the protectionist sake of newspaper lobbyists. So I ding-dong, I dance on the grave for now, but I'm afraid it's going to come back. So I think it's worth mentioning.
It's just nuts. It's nuts.
It is.
Let's do the, Benito, if you would, the Google changelog.
The Google changelog.
Some nice new additions to Google Photos, some collage editing. Look at these cute collages. I really like them.
Collage or collage?
I don't know.
Collage.
Am I saying it wrong? Collage? You say collage?
I say collage.
But you're French.
I'm also a southerner.
You might know better.
Let me just look it up in the dictionary. Well,
pronounce. Just say pronounce collage. And it'll
collage. Collage. You ready?
Yeah. Collage.
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 Oh, but yeah, wait a minute. Alternate pronunciation. Collage.
Oh, all right. For alternate people.
So both are correct.
Collage.
I said both are correct. Google is rolling out a collage editor. This looks kind of cool. They look more like cards, right? Yeah. These are updates to Memories. Advanced collage editor. and you can also make more videos with you can trim long ones to the most meaningful moments. Still images will feature a subtle zoom in and out, kind of like a new, you know.
Ken
here
Burns.
We go. Ken Burns effect. Yeah, look, see, it's zooming in. That's nice. It really does make it still kind of come alive. So the zooming in and out, zooming in and out. And they add.
Was it like to create a visual cliche that gets named after you?
Ken Burns.
Right.
He,
yeah, right.
So it be, you know, the Ken Burns effect, which we first saw in the Civil War, right? And it really solved a problem because there's no video from the Civil War. There's no movies. So he had a lot of still pictures. So he said, we'll pan and zoom on these. So you zoom in, but or you pan across them. And so they come to life. But then Apple said, oh, we're going to build, oh, that's neat. We'll build that into iMovie. And they called it the Ken Burns effect without asking him.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Didn't know that.
Very famously. And he called. They said, what the hell, Apple? That's my name. You can't just, you can't just name
goodness.
Something the Ken Burns effect. So they negotiated. I think he got a bunch of free Macs or something. But eventually he was satisfied with it. But I don't think he was that happy about it. It's really,
okay.
It's called pan and scan is the technical term for it. So, yeah, I don't think he was that happy that he became so associated with this.
That's so funny.
Cliched. It's cliched now. When he did Civil War, it was pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
And he also...
I never liked that.
He got David McCullough to not narrate it. And, you know, Shelby Foote and people. I thought it was pretty good. All right. Let's see. Here is cinematic memories are rolling out that transform multiple still photos into an end-to-end... Oh, we just saw this. This is cinematic. No, this is a different one. Spotlight on Anna. Wow, they're even doing like perspective.
Yeah, that's
how do they
what do you
that?
Call that when the one thing stays still and the thing is otherwise move? What's that called? What's happening right
I
now?
I don't know.
Oh.
Call that rotoscoping?
No, perspective. It's the perspective shift. Yeah. But I don't know. I'm sure it's Alex Lindsay would have a name.
I don't know what the technical name is for it.
Yeah. Chat room. What do you call that?
It's
when
pretty, though.
The foreground moves at different speed than the background.
Oh, parallax.
Yeah, it's kind of like parallax shift. Yeah.
Parallax, duh.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. But that's hard. I mean, they're obviously doing it computationally because this is a still photo. So that's, I don't know how they're doing that. That's cool.
I've been enjoying the little memories.
Oh, I love them.
And these little updates coming from Google. I don't necessarily share them out or anything like that, but it's nice when I get the little reminders. Oh, look at this from 7 years ago and the stuff that I've totally forgotten about. And it just takes you away from those.
It's funny because Apple, you know, as usual with Apple, iOS 16, we're going to add this great new thing that lets you share a photo album with other people and then they can add to it and you can add to it. It's going to be so great. We'll call it, I think, shared memories. Something Google Photos has been doing for as long as I can remember. And then now they announce, oh, you know, it's so hard to do. We're going to put that off. It won't be coming out with the new iOS 16. We'll do that. You'll get that later this year. It's
right,
like, dude,
right.
Google's been doing this since 2015. Right. What are you smoking over there at Cupertino? All right. Let's see. What else? I'm back to shakshuka somehow. Why were we? Oh, this is like. He's using robin's eggs to make shakshuka or something.
So this guy, to me, this is Salt Hank with a posh accent.
Oh, I see. His name is Julius Oh, look at his little grill there.
Oh, yeah. No, it's quite precious. Posh.
It's too precious. No, I think Salt Hank with the fast edits, the fast cuts, the chop, the loud noise.
Much better.
That's
accent is very,
well,
very
I'll turn on some sound. You can hear his Oxbridge. His received pronunciation.
A couple of cloves of garlic, give them a smash.
No, he's just like Saul Hank.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a young, good-looking gentleman cooking.
Exactly.
Which drives the ladies crazy because they don't have to cook anymore. Google has jumped on the iOS 16 bandwagon with their own widgets for Gmail, Maps, and more. iOS, you know, just got this feature on the lock screen. So Google, you know, being Google, not laughing like Samsung would do, not mocking them, has decided to make some stuff. That's nice. I actually love these new lock screens. You want to see what I'm doing now with the lock screen? You have the over the shoulder, Benito, do you? Let me find it. Here it is. So one of the things you can do with a lock screen is you can have every time you unlock it, it gives you a new picture. So I put an album of, you know, I said all the pictures I have of Lisa. So every time I, you can't see it, but it's all right, you can see it this way. Every time it locks, I get a new picture of my wife, which I think is, you know, I think that's really, and it's random. It's
pretty cool.
It's from my photo album. So that's kind of cool. You could put pets in there, or you could put pets and your wife.
What's the purple flashing thing?
That's the sensor.
Wow. The cameras pick that up, don't they? I don't see it in real life. Wow.
No, you won't see it, but the camera's there.
That's the depth sensor. It's saying,
oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Saying,
where's your face, Leo? Where's your face?
If you put your phone up to your camera, Mr. Jarvis, you'll see it too.
Wow, that's cool.
Wow.
Yeah, and see, every picture is different, so that's
even
nice.
Even
that's
Android? Pretty
cool. Yeah. It says Android have a depth sensor?
Yeah.
LiDAR?
Yes,
yeah. Whatever they call it. Get more done.
You have to have a black screen, though, sir. Dark mode.
Hey, what's no? I don't like that. Ant.
Show us that screen again. That's interesting. So you have a hole punch on there. Is it like a dynamic island? Does it grow and shrink? Does it do anything? It just sits there like a hole, just like a hole. Okay. Get more done. Have fun. With new Android features. What's this? This is the keyword.
Where can I shock Leo?
Zzz. All right. Just sits there like a hole. Okay. Gosh, that's interesting choice. Nearby Share. This we've been promised this forever. I think it's using Bluetooth LE. I don't know. But somehow it's, you know, Apple would do it with the UWB chip. I don't know if Google has something similar. But you can share somebody nearby. Transfer. Oh, I guess it's just AirDrop.
AirDrop. Okay. Right.
Yeah, it's AirDrop. Google Workspace apps, updated Google Drive widget, new emojis. There's a whole bunch of stuff. Gboard lets you emojify your messages. Type your message, then hit the emojify button, and actual words are replaced by inscrutable pictures.
Is emojify a verb that you have used in the past?
Never before, but notice how trippingly it flowed off my tongue.
Yes, you did. It did.
Unlike
it
collage. Collage. You can do the emoji kitchen, lets you make mashed potatoes out of your emojis. Actually, that was cool. They took the 100 and the Canadian maple leaf, smooshed them together to make a maple leaf.
Something.
100. Okay. You can instantly co-watch YouTube videos and play classic games together with up to 100 friends and family members at a time in Google Meet. I think we mentioned this before, new features in Google Meet. So Google, I think, you know, they did this right at the Apple event. I think they're just trying to say, hey, we can do stuff too. So this might be a value to deaf people. Design in partnership with deaf and hard of hearing community, sound notifications within live transcribe and notifications can detect critical household sounds like fire alarms, running water, door knocks, and it will tell you on your phone or watch in text when they occur.
With custom sound notifications on Android, you can train your device to recognize, detect, and label specific household sounds. It's easy to miss an alert because you didn't hear it. That's why Google Research partnered with deaf and hard of hearing communities to detect and label custom sounds. You'll automatically receive alerts for sounds in your home, like when the doorbell rings, if the baby starts crying, and if there's a siren on your street. But you can also train your device to recognize specifics. Just tap and hold to start recording. Add a label and edit anytime. And you can even personalize how you want to be notified, so you can see a flash when someone's knocking at the
door. Okay if Google's always listening to you. It's for your own good.
Telling you when the dryer is done.
That's exactly what they're wanting to say.
And the benefits extend to everyone. Like in a situation where you could miss a sound, so you can get a notification when you're wearing noise-canceling headphones, or even when your phone is in the other room. So now you can access your alerts on time and on your own terms.
I think that's a nice feature.
Custom sound notifications on Android.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
can
they
Apple
should.
Do that?
No, not that I know of.
See?
They should.
See?
They should say, and I'm going to assume it's done all on device, because otherwise you would literally be sending everything going on all around you back to the Google servers, and ain't nobody going to want to do that. But that's a great idea. Now, if they can only give me a new name for Hey You Know Who, I would really be happy.
There's some new features for Wear OS. That actually is a feature that you can use on the watch. Google, as you know, October 6th is expected to announce their new Pixel watch, which looks pretty sweet. Yeah. You can use a keep tile to dictate a note or checklist on the watch and send it to the phone. Okay, good. Bitmoji is coming to Wear OS. Oh, hallelujah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's as if Google had, you know, this is kind of like the Apple event, but in a blog post. It's very cool. September 8th. Android 13 QPR 1 Beta 1 is out. There's a whole list of new features. Thank you, 9to5 Google, if you want to check it out. Spatial audio, interesting for Google. Honestly, it's a back and forth thing. Apple steals from Google, to Google steals from Apple.
Well, remember, I was thinking about this the other day. Remember when they were suing the bejesus out of each other?
Yeah, that was stupid.
Or any little thing. Oh, you can't have a round button? We invented the round button. And that's all gone now because they just
it's cross-pollinization, and everybody knows that's how flowers grow. So it's good. There's actually some interesting things going on, I think, with hearing aids on both platforms. As you know, next month, the FCC or FTC? No, FDA. FDA is scheduled to announce over-the-counter hearing aids, that you won't have to go to an audiologist to buy expensive hearing aids. You'll be able to buy them over-the-counter. And I think both Apple and Google are watching with great interest. Google has some hearing aid features in its new phone, including the ability to amplify sounds coming into the microphone of the phone via your headphones. Apple's expected to do that also with their new AirPods 2. In fact, it's thought they may have some hearing aid features in the AirPods 2 they didn't want to announce until next month because they are hearing aid style features. Certainly,
what would a hearing aid like feature be?
Well, one of the things, I use hearing aids sometimes. One of the problems with the normal hearing aids is they're not full fidelity. They're designed to improve voices. Of course, AirPod 2 is full fidelity. So one of the things, for instance, you can already do with the AirPods is you can, if you have an audiologist test or you take an audio test on your iPhone, drag it into the profile on your hearing, on your AirPods, and that will now adjust the AirPods frequency response for your hearing. You can with the iPhone, use the iPhone camera to actually map the inside of your ear and send that to the AirPods, which aids in the creation of spatial sound.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
There's some speculation. You know, there's a speaker now on the AirPods charger. There's some speculation that many of us would be a microphone, but they haven't announced it because that will be the kind of thing you would, let's say, put on a podium while Jeff is lecturing and you're sitting in the back. You can't really hear them and you could hear them.
Well, or in my father's old folks' home.
Yes, exactly.
You put it on the table.
It's like a television coil that you put in so you can hear the TV. Or you put it on the table during dinner. So there are a lot of new features that
Just confuses my father. It doesn't work. But.
Well, this is an interesting one. The AirPods also can automatically improve speech, so they can change the curve to hear speech.
Wow.
But they also announced this. It can, if you go by something that's very loud, like they showed a jackhammer or a siren, the noise cancellation will adjust to cancel out those very loud noises to protect your hearing. So there, I really believe both Google and Apple are moving towards this idea that their in-ear buds are going to be kind of hearing aids without having the stigma.
Well, it sounds like also there'll be so many features that even if you're not hard of hearing.
Oh, we'll all benefit.
We'll see people wearing them all the time, even more than now.
Yep, you bet. I think that's the intent. I mean, they showed at the Apple event a woman in a subway, and it's, you know, tuning out the subway noise and going, getting out of the subway. There's a jackhammer tuning that out, going into a cafe. The impression you get is, yeah. Oh, and they also announced, I think, I can't remember the length, but much longer battery life. Still not full day, which you'd need for a hearing aid, but much longer.
I hope it doesn't tune out the honking bus that's about to hit you.
Yeah, let's hope not. I don't think it would. No.
Okay.
Pixel 6a September update is coming out with... same old fingerprint sensor improvements. Jeez, they still can't get it right. Oh, Lord.
That update we mentioned last week
with
the battery life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't do a thing.
No difference.
Didn't, did not okay. get any better, unfortunately.
How fast is your fingerprint reader now? Our loyal,
it's fine.
Loyal listeners will know that Ant finally gave up on his Pixel 6 XL, traded in, and his new one is fine, including the speed of the fingerprint reader. That's good.
Yep.
Glad to hear that.
Totally fine.
Yeah, I never had trouble, and so I thought maybe that was a specific to the phone. Google is also previewing Android's new emoji ahead of the December launch, including an animated collection that looks like a ghostly happy face. You want to see some of the new emoji on their way? There's a hair pick. There's a hand saying, talk to the hand. There's maracas. there's ginger root, peas, chocolate chip cookies, donkeys, fans. A lot of, we talked, I think, about these before, but they're coming in December. And dancing emotes.
Emotes?
Emotes, they're calling these, not emoji.
So you emotify or you emojify?
The first, say hello to our first set of animations. Scan the collection, download in your preferred file format, and watch them dance like this little guy here, the John Travolta.
This looks very Apple-y emoji. To me.
Yeah. Color font support. Oh, look. You can really make your duck be very colorful. Customized emotes. No lime emoji, no problem. Bring the green heart and the yellow lemon together and you'll get a green lime. Make it a yellow rose with a yellow heart. Feeling goth, put some black heart on your lipstick. Go Cardinals, turn the Twitter bird from blue to red.
Why not just give me those?
Yeah.
Well, instead of making me make them.
Because we want you in the kitchen. That's where you belong, Aunt. That's where you belong. And that's the Google Change Log.
Oh, man.
Oh, my. This was fun. It was so great to meet and talk with Matt Mullenweg. What a great show.
I'm so happy you did that.
Thank you, Matt. Let's finish up, though, with our picks of the week. No Stacy this week, so we'll start with you, Aunt Pruitt.
All right. For mine, I just want to say thank you to Google, because I got an alert yesterday evening
as
I was sitting here at my desk. And I got to tell you, this Southern man, that was some weird stuff.
Was that your first quake?
That was my first earthquake.
Oh.
It was a very mild quake, I must say.
That's what's funny is people was like, that was nothing. And I'm thinking, dang, what does a bad one feel like?
Here's what it looked like on my phone. We were in a restaurant, and the whole restaurant came alive with a burp, burp. And this is the emergency alert that popped up on our phones. Earthquake detected. Drop. Cover. Hold on. Protect yourself. USGS shake alert. And it, I didn't feel it, but Lisa felt it. She said it was about a second or two. So it wasn't before the earthquake. It was a little bit earlier than the earthquake. But we were right on the epicenter. So
it happened right. My alert went off like right as the house started shaking. It was like simultaneously.
Yeah.
And
I think, do we have the video from All About Android? Because they were in studio when it happened.
Yeah. They were doing the show.
Yeah. They felt it though, right? I believe Jason said he did. I think you could see it even. I don't know where I could find
that. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, this isn't the bad one. It's funny.
Oh, this is nothing.
Oh, no.
It was 4.4, dude.
Queen Pruitt was rehearsing as usual. And so I thought it was her just sort of coming down the hallway because we were both upstairs. I thought it was just her walking down the hallway, stomping and dancing. And it got louder. And all of my gear in here started shaking. And then she was like, uh-oh. And I said, earthquake. So she stopped and the phone was screaming and whatnot. It was just very, very weird. I'm glad that Google at least put that alert out there. I never thought I'd see it, but
here's the
cool. Good on you, Google.
Here's the All About Android video. Right after your plug to subscribe to Hands-On Photography.
Thank you.
Android. Oh, wait a minute. No, you gave me the... Oh, is it on the bloopers?
Yeah, you can hear it.
Oh, earthquake.
Drop, there's cover, hold on, protect yourself. I'm getting the alert.
There's the sound.
Is it the first time we've had an earthquake live on the show?
Earthquake detected. Drop, cover, hold on, protect yourself.
Do I drop, cover, and hold on?
don't know.
What do I do? Yeah, that was a little bit of a shake there.
I didn't feel it at all.
Wow.
Did you?
Why, oh, yeah. Why did you guys stay on Ron?
I'm on a platform. Sorry.
Yeah.
Ooh. Okay.
So we couldn't see it.
My heart's beating a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I think so. It was.
Oh, there it is.
Wait, nothing's rocking at all.
It's still going. Did you see it? There's a little
camera. The shock.
Oh. Look at the monitor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the aftershock.
We can kind of see it on the Zoom.
So it wasn't bad. It really was very mild. Oh, yeah. Wait till you get a real earthquake. You will then enjoy.
Yeah, that's what really freaked me out. I was a bit beside myself. Just,
yeah.
It's like, wow, the world is moving and I'm sitting here. Just,
oh, wait till you get a real one. Then it really is. It is very much like that. Like this earth should not move like this. This is not.
In all my time in San Francisco, I had only one, and I was on a Muni bus at the time, and there was no way to feel it.
Yeah.
The Muni bus earthquakes more than the city.
Yeah, it's pretty, yeah. I was at the
dogs freaked out. They started barking.
Oh, did they? Oh,
the 89 quake, the really bad one, where the bridge fell and we had fires in the Marina District and everything. I was at Candlestick Park for the World Series game.
Oh, right. You were there?
Yeah. And it was really scary because the light standards, they were moving 15, 20 feet like this, back and forth.
Amazing.
And the whole crowd, I mean, it's like freaking. But the best part is the players ran out of the dugout, grabbed their kids from the stands and ran into the middle of the field and just stood there looking around while the rest of us are going, what should we do?
Right.
So we sat there for a while. It was a really good example of how rumors spread because some people had radios and TVs. And by the time the story got to us, the bridge had fallen down. The city was sunk into the water, you know, all just horrific stuff. My friend, the guy I was with, was a San Francisco native. He said, let's go. The lights were all out. The street lights were out. The traffic lights were out. But he knew his way around town. He was able to get me back to the radio station, and we went on the air. But it was, it was you. And when you get a real one, you will know. And honestly, there's two ways to think about these. This is the second small tremor in the area. There was one in the Waldo Grade a couple of days before. It's either the fault letting pressure off, so, that's good, or it's building up to the big one. So
let's go with A, sir.
Yeah, let's go
with A.
Let's go with A. Yeah. Yeah. The studio, we're not on a slab, are we? Do you know? I don't know if we're on a...
I think you'd be.
Yeah, I don't know what we're on.
What's the problem if you're on a slab? It's not
that's good.
Enough?
We were on a slab down at a restaurant, so I hardly felt it. But if you're a wooden structure, you know, on wooden walls, you're going to definitely feel it more, especially if you're not on bedrock, if you're on.
Right. My neighbor was like, you're upstairs, so it definitely feels worse upstairs.
Yeah. And, that makes sense.
It's like, okay, well, that makes sense.
Yeah, this building's on a slab, Burke says. It's a tilt-up, so I don't know how much we'd feel it, unless it was really bad.
Now, was I supposed to go and stand in up under a doorway?
No.
Or
that is the old news. You are not supposed to get under a doorway. It turns out those are worse, not better. Okay. So don't go stand under a doorway.
Jason should have gotten
under the desk would be a good idea. Just in case, you know, here probably under the desk would be a very good idea because of the lights.
Yeah. Lights will fall.
Stuff falling off the ceiling. If the building falls down, being under a desk isn't going to help.
The first thing I did was look up.
Like, what's going on?
Well, I'm not
going
to move.
Yeah.
And Queen Pruitt, she just sort of stood over there in the door. Because she was, like I said, I thought she was just sort of goofing off and dancing in the hallway. And
that's just Queen Pruitt rehearsing.
Right, that's what she does. She's singing those daggum songs every other minute. And it's just, you know, whatever. But it got worse.
You're supposed to drop. This is what the advice was. Drop onto your hands and knees. Before the earthquake knocks you down, it protects you from falling. This is from the CDC, but allows you to still move if necessary. Then cover your head and neck, if you can, under a sturdy table or desk.
Yep. Okay.
But it says do not go into a doorway.
How many years was that the advice?
Forever.
It was all my childhood.
Yeah.
For a guy out in the country in the South, that's what we were told. But
yeah, for years, that's what we were told. Yeah. That is, the CDC changes things all the time.
Oh, moving target. But thank you, Google, for that alert. I thought that was
pretty Wasn't that interesting? That's along with your amber alerts and your tornado warnings and all that. It's the first time I've ever seen an earthquake alert, but it works. Oh. And because we were in a restaurant, it a lot of people, I mean, you really knew. Everybody's looking around.
Right.
Yeah, it's good. An enduring image of California in an earthquake is a collapsed adobe home with the door frame as the only standing part. From this came our belief that a doorway is the safest place to be in an earthquake.
Oh.
True, if you live in an old, unreinforced adobe house. In other words, if your house is made of clay, sure, get in the doorway. Or some older wood frame houses. In modern houses, doorways are no stronger than any other part of the house. And the doorway does not protect you from the most likely source of injury, falling or flying objects. So you're safer under a table.
See, I don't think people were meant to live in California. I think they were meant to go and see and say, isn't this pretty? And let's leave it pristine and then leave.
So pretty. But you got tornadoes, dude.
Oh,
hurricanes. And Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You've got Bedminster.
I got Donald Trump nearby. Yeah. I do have that.
What else? You got one more thing, Ant?
Oh, I forgot about my other thing. We sing his praises every daggum Wednesday as we start the show. And this was a great article on PC Mag featuring Mr. Craig Newmark. And the title of it is just... I love the title of it. But if you read it, it's just a great read. He's just being himself and genuine. And
he is
the person interviewing him, there was even a point in there where they were like, you know what? I don't even know if I can continue to take these answers seriously because they're just so frank and straightforward. But it was all candid. It's just it was a good read.
We love him.
Such a good read.
And remember, he is studying stand-up comedy, so maybe you shouldn't take him too seriously. We got to get him on again. I enjoyed having him on. That was fun.
Yeah, it'd be great. Yeah. We need him on. We need to do the Dave Weiner thing you were suggesting.
Oh, I love talking to the pioneers, the guys who started the internet. You know, that's always my favorite thing. Thank you, Ant. Don't forget Ant_Pruitt on Twitter, Instagram, and Vero. What the hell? Why not?
That's right. And Vero.
Yeah.
I'm there every now and then.
And Vero. And don't forget, of course, he is the Master of Ceremonies in our Club Twit Discord. Did we decide on a book for Stacy's book club?
We did. The book is A Long Way to the Small Angry Planet.
Oh, good.
I think I got that right. And we just got the agenda, the schedule for our next meeting is October 27th, 9 a.m. Pacific for the book club.
Nice.
But before that, the 22nd of September, I'm going to be chatting with some Club Twit members in a fireside chat.
Very good.
So
that's just some of the things that go on in Club Twit. Of course, there's great conversations in the Discord all the time about all kinds of topics, not just the shows that are on now, but anime and autos and beer and books and coding and comics and current affairs. And that's just the B's and the C's. It goes on and on and on. There's even a TikTok corner for you, Jeff Jarvis.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
I've had that in there for weeks.
Yes.
I put more in there than you have.
Get in there, Jeff.
You need to fix that.
It's turned out to be one of the great benefits of Club Twit, but really the main reason we started it is because people said we want ad-free versions of the show. So for $7 a month, you get ad-free versions of all of our shows. You get the Discord. You get the Twit Plus feed. And you're subsidizing shows that don't have enough advertising support for us to do otherwise. Things like Hands on Mac with Micah Sargent, Hands on Windows with Paul Thurrott, The Untitled Linux Show with Jonathan Bennett, The Giz Fizz with Dick DiBartolo, Stacy's Book Club. This Week in Space started in the club. So it really is a way, and it really helps us. Lisa just told me 25% of our revenue now comes from the club. So it's especially as advertising starts to, you know, get a little slower during recession.
Thank you, people. Thank you.
It really helps us. You can also get shows individually for $2.99 a month if you just want one show ad free. But all of that is at clubtwit.tv or just go to twit.tv/clubtwit. Either one will work.
Soon I'll propose the Gutenberg Club.
Yeah, sure. It'll just it's basically a drinking club. Everybody just take a shot.
That's what I say. We'll all be in there like that the whole time.
Thank you, Ann, for doing that. And of course, Ann hosts Hands on Photography, twit.tv/hop every
week. What have you got for us, Mr. J?
I'll do this one. YouTube is bragging, for good reason, that they paid $6 billion to the music industry in the last 12 months.
Wow.
In royalties. Up 50%.
Wow.
$4 billion in 2021, now $6 billion. We want our twin engines of ads and subscriptions to be the number one contributor of revenue to the industry by 2025.
Now, here, this is interesting because I would have thought, oh, that's YouTube Music's royalties, but it's mostly from creatives who are using music in their videos. They say, we also pioneered the monetization of user-generated content. 30% of the payouts for artists, songwriters, and rent holders for the second year in a row came from videos using real music where there was a payout. So yeah, that's interesting. That's, you know, maybe an unintended. But remember, they tried to shut that down for a long time. Right.
And of course, this is the newspaper industry. Oh, go ahead.
Can you explain to me how that works? I don't even know how that works. If I were to do a video and get a song from, I don't know, Mariah Carey and put it as the music bed, I'm going to get a notice of copyright, blah, 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 and it goes away. They'll make me put another song in there.
Or
that
no.
doesn't necessarily mean Mariah Carey got paid, right?
No, I think, tell me if I'm wrong here, Leo, isn't it that you can keep it up there, but the money, but whatever money came to you is going to go to Mariah.
So there's a couple of things happening.
Oh.
There is, YouTube has made deals, and I'm sure more will come, just as TikTok has done, and others, with the record labels. So there is music you can just use, and you won't risk a copyright strike.
Oh, okay.
But if you just use music, there are three things that the label, a copyright holder, actually it's the publisher of the music, it's the copyright holder. The three things a copyright holder can do. One is take you down and give you a copyright strike. That's what we always get for something. Another would be to demonetize you. Say, you're not going to make any money off of this.
Yeah, I've seen that notice.
And then the third one, and apparently this is a popular one, is, oh, fine, but we will get all the money from your monetization as
that's
royalties.
Yeah. The third one.
The third one, yeah.
Yeah, which is okay.
Interesting that it's 30%.
It's actually, you're using it. This is what the newspaper industry looks at and says, hey, where's our $6 billion? Except that, you know, a headline is not a unique song by Mariah Carey. It's just a piece of information.
Right, right. I think if you use shorts, you can license. I think there's way, you know, as a creator, you can use licensed music, which would be, of course, the better way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the money would go to.
Go to the creator.
The creator. The publisher. Well, this is another long story, but it goes to the publisher, which isn't necessarily the label or the artist.
Yeah, true.
That's why you always want to write your own music. And you want, and just as Motley Crue did, you want to keep the rights to your music.
Yeah.
$6 billion. Spotify's numbers are close to that, I think.
Really?
Let me see. Let me see what the music industry payout was. $7 billion. A little bit more.
Jeez.
A little bit more. That's in 2021. That's to labels, publishers, and others. Yeah, that's more than anybody else. But still,
importantly here, it's the music industry is the one medium. It was hit first by the snowball that became an avalanche down the mountain that is the internet. And it screwed up. And I was teaching this in class last week, but it was the first one and the only one, I think, to date to really figure out how to do this. Will Page, the former chief economist at Spotify, has a great piece he did in the FT about 2 years ago, taking us through the numbers, where the explosion of creativity that now exists is amazing without the gatekeepers that existed before. So that I think this similar, an equivalent number of songs are released every day as the UK used to release albums in a year. And the number of genres goes from hundreds to thousands that exist. And so the music industry still has a blockbuster economy, still wants to have a Mariah Carey, still wants to have the big guys, but they learned how to make money on the long tail, as we used to say. Nobody else has really done that yet. I mean, books haven't really, though you have Wattpad, you have that kind of stuff happening, which is kind of interesting. Magazines certainly haven't figured it out. Newspapers haven't figured it out because They're not for a whole bunch of creators. They don't have the Matt Mullenweg view of many canvases and many paintbrushes. It's our canvas and it's our paintbrush.
Yeah.
So music, you know, finally figured it out. It's about to get back to where it was, and it's going to succeed from here. It's good to see.
If you would like to, it is estimated that hundreds of thousands of people are going to London right now to view the Queen's casket in state. There is currently a 2-mile long line. If you want to watch it, it's being streamed live by, this is a live video, from the chapel, from the BBC.
Kind of the Francisco Franco stream. She's still dead.
Yeah. No, that's mean. That's just mean.
Oh, it's an old SNL joke.
I know.
Oh, but, okay.
Yeah. So the funeral is on Monday. So she will be lying in state and people. You know, I'll never forget one of the things I did when we were in Beijing is went to see Mao's tomb. Because he's, I don't know if it's a wax effigy or whatever, but or he's just well embalmed, but he's lying there. And you can see him, see his face. And there is a constant mile-long line of people from all over the country, from all over China, going to see Mao all these years later. This was 2009 or 10.
Wow.
All these years after his death. And really some years after he was somewhat discredited, but there's still a lot of reverence for Chairman Mao and people bring flowers and I'll never forget seeing this. So they come, they lay flowers, on the casket. Well, it's not a casket. He's in a glass, like Lennon is, he's in a glass jar, you know, bell jar kind of thing. And, they put flowers down and of course there's so many people going by, these flowers pile up. So they gather all the flowers up. And then I noticed they're bringing them out back and they're reselling them
no.
to the next bunch of people. This is not happening for the Queen. I don't believe there are any flowers. It's actually a very solemn. I don't know if we're getting audio. I guess we are, but there's not much to hear.
It's the echoey halls.
You could leave that on, Benita.
It could be taken down for the sound of the
initial sound. I think we're all right on this one. And you can see, it's interesting, you see the guards with the big fur hats with their heads bowed, and then the beef eaters around with their heads bowed, and then the bobbies at the corners standing there with their heads bowed. It's quite a touching memorial.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's live at bbc.com if you want to watch it. I don't think they stream Chairman Mao's bell jar, but I don't know. I might be wrong. Could be wrong.
How about Lennon's?
Lennon's tomb. I've not seen that. I would love to go. You know, get the whole, collect all the whole set. I don't know who else is there. Is Stalin's body there somewhere? Yeah, Ho Chi Minh is.
Get Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition.
Done it again.
Of This Week in Google. Catch Ant Pruitt on Hands-On Photography. When is the Queen Pruitt's big day? Is it coming up?
It's in November.
Okay.
I think it starts November.
We're all going.
There's something like that.
I don't know if you know this. Next Friday, we're all going to see Roger Waters. Then the following month, we'll all go see Queen Pruitt in the SpongeBob musical. Very excited.
She would be so excited.
We'll fill a row. You. It'll be great. I can't wait. Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Of course. Jeff Jarvis is performing as the director of the Townite Center for the Entrepreneurial Journalism at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of York. Classes every Wednesday. And his blog is at buzzmachine.com and Medium, I think, still, yes, at Jeff Jarvis.
Mm-hmm.
And his book on Gutenberg is forthcoming. Anything else to plug?
Nope, not yet. I'll be plugging then.
Good. Thank you, JJ. Thank you, Mr. Pruitt. Thank you all for joining us. We do Twig every Wednesday afternoon, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC. Watch it live at live.twit.tv. Get a copy after the fact at twit.tv/twig or on YouTube, or subscribe in your favorite podcast client. In fact, if you do that, you'll get it automatically. You don't even have to think about it. Just listen whenever you're in the mood. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.
Don't miss All About Android every week. We talk about the latest news, hardware, apps, and now all the developer-y goodness happening in the Android ecosystem. I'm Jason Howell, also joined by Ron Richards, Florence Ion, and our newest co-host on the panel, Wen Tu Dao, who brings her developer chops. Really great stuff. We also invite people from all over the Android ecosystem to talk about this mobile platform we love so much. Join us every Tuesday, All About Android, on twit.tv.